Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solera Report. I'm having fun because I'm sitting with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and we've been talking each other's heads off. I just got, I'm guilty of bad habits because I stayed up way too late last night reading his new book, which is a doozy. This is part one of News Trends and Stories for the third quarter wrap-up. What an explosive quarter we've had. And I'm just so delighted that Joseph is back to help us make sense of this. This is part one. We'll be talking about the economy, financial markets, and geopolitics. Part two, which will be next week, is culture, science, technology, the unanswered questions, go local, and inspiration. One of the things Joseph and I have concluded is that the most important part is culture, which threads through everything, and we'll focus on it next time. We'll bring it up this time. So it's a pleasure always to welcome Joseph to the Solera Report. Joseph, welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
Oh, my God. It's a sunny, beautiful day, and I'm with the voice
well,
of Sandy.
Sunny, yes. Beautiful, no. It's, it's not raining, so it's not beautiful.
Anyway, so first, before we get going, I want to update everybody about the crowdfund and the book. So why don't we start with the book? I haven't finished it yet because you plopped it on me late last night after I got in from a long, long drive and I couldn't put it down. So I'm looking forward to finishing it. But you have a new book. You've kept this under tight wrap.
I tried.
You tried. So tell us about the new book.
The new book is called Hess and the Penguins. And the subtitle is The Holocaust, Antarctica, and the Strange Case of Rudolf Hess. Because, just to put it in a nutshell, most people don't realize the significance of the Hess case. But you get a measure of the significance by the fact that most of the documents in the Hess case are set to declassify this year, the same year as the JFK assassination. So that should give people kind of the measure of the importance of it. Uh-huh. And when they read the book, I think they'll discover that there were certain parties very interested in keeping him under wraps for various reasons for most of his life. I don't want to give away the plot, but he essentially was on a peace mission to Great Britain, but the peace that he was proposing was extremely comprehensive. Right. Basically, to put it in a nutshell, I think what he and certain parties in Great Britain were trying to do was realign the geopolitical structure of the world completely, mm-hmm. cut the Soviet Union out of it, cut the United States out of it, and make Europe under some sort of Anglo-German hegemony, make Europe the predominant power. So
right.
it was a huge gamble. They came very close. Most people don't realize how close they came.
Right. Well, it's absolutely fascinating. Of course, everybody's been asking you, peppering you for years, what's going on in Antarctica? And the reality is you can't discuss that without looking at some of the deep history.
Right.
And there's a very deep history here.
Oh, there's a huge history. Yeah. Hess was involved, in my opinion, in a plot that also involved Hermann Göring, who, of course, was the sponsor of the Nazi Antarctic expedition. So there was something definitely going on between those two regarding Antarctica. And I think, as part of the peace that he was proposing, that Antarctica was definitely on the table for discussion with Great Britain. The simplest explanation is simply there's a lot of resources, untapped resources in Antarctica.
Right.
And I think this was a case of let's just divvy the pot.
Right. Okay, well, now we can go to your website, Giza Death Star, and we can link and order the book. The book's available now for order.
The book is available. I have not yet linked it on the website.
Oh, you haven't?
I haven't. So they either have to get it directly from Adventures Unlimited Press, or they can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
And get it there.
Okay. Okay. So the second thing is our wonderful organ master, organ maker, Chris Martin, has been buried in the same kind of shadow work that you and I get.
Yeah, apparently.
I'm laughing because it's not fun. You know, we laugh so as not to cry is the old Mel Brooks expression. Anyway, but we are now hoping we're going to get it for November. And I'm thinking, what an appropriate time for you to receive your organ, but in the middle of Thanksgiving.
It would be nice.
It would be nice. Okay, so we don't have the organ has not been delivered. We're hoping it'll be delivered by Thanksgiving. And, you know, what I want to put out just a MailChimp message to all the donors just to let them know what's going on. I see you have purchased more music.
I purchased more music. I've been trying to rebuild my music library.
Uh-huh.
In all of my moves over the years, I lost a lot of my organ music. I retained most of the volumes of the old Vidor Schweitzer Bach edition. I've purchased the Baronrider, which is the critical text of the scores. I've replenished some Vidor scores in the critical text, and a fellow that I call my secret weapon, or used to call my secret weapon, who is the last student of J.S. Bach. That's
wow.
A very interesting composer to listen to if you haven't heard him
right.
before.
Right, and you've redecorated your living room.
I've redecorated
the living room. The living room is prepared to receive
yes,
the organ.
I don't know about all the boxes, but the living room is at least set up for a space that I cleared out for.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so hopefully.
Oh, but look, the artwork. You have the picture of the Harlem Cathedral up over.
Yeah, I've got a picture of one of my favorite instruments, which is in Harlem, Holland. It's the Miller organ there. Most organists will be familiar with that instrument. It's a lovely Baroque era instrument. Have some pictures of some of my favorite organ grinders.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but our wonderful ally, Yaron von Straten, who
right.
lives in Harlem.
He lives in Harlem.
I've had lunch with him in Harlem. He insists that he's going to get permission when the day should come for you to play the Harlem organ. And I've agreed that when he does and when you're ready, I will sail you to Europe because we know you don't fly.
Well, that instrument, I told Yaron this, that instrument's a tracker, and tracker instruments, you require a lot of physical stamina to play
yeah.
those things. The key depression is about a full inch
wow.
on that instrument, and
right.
you're overcoming the pressure of the mechanical action in the instrument. So your hands have to be very strong. I haven't played
a tracker
in years.
I've been on an organ tour of Europe because, we went to Verona this summer to see Beethoven in the arena.
Right.
But discovered that the cathedrals were all having free concerts and everyone had organs.
Right.
So it was quite remarkable. And then, of course, I went to Iceland and was in the cathedral there, which is magnificent and
right.
with a magnificent organ, much newer.
Well, the Dutch are good about keeping their instruments up, keeping them
right.
in repair and introducing young kids. A lot of the world's organists right now are very young. They come from Germany and Holland, which
right.
I'm glad that the instrument's having a little bit of a revival. And China, believe it or not, they're building pipe organs like crazy
really?
In China.
Really?
You see these organs with all this Chinese decoration.
So I'm not sure the folks who funded the organ realize this, but you're getting these because the pipes for your organ are digital.
Right.
You've bought all these components where you can switch between different
right.
organs of Europe. So
right.
all the time you can switch from Harlem to
right.
Notre Dame or whatever.
We've got three organ sound samples and a harpsichord sound sample. So
uh-huh.
this will actually double as a pedal harpsichord, which is
wow.
another one of my favorite instruments. But yeah, you can buy sound samples for a lot of famous organs now for your virtual pipe organs. And I've occasionally put up links on my website for people that can listen to them.
Uh-huh.
I put up some Vidor on the forum and so on. You can actually hear these virtual pipe organs using a sound sample from some famous organ
right.
somewhere. So it's
right.
it's a very interesting technology. I think ultimately I hope it will revive the instrument. It's very, very difficult in this country to get on a decent, large instrument to practice because they guard them,
Right,
with,
right.
more than they do the sacraments, unfortunately. But
well, I for one, am really looking forward to this organ coming.
So am I.
So we'll have an update on the annual wrap-up. Because hopefully you'll be here. Okay, let's dive in. You and I sat last night, and normally, we have a great web presentation on for the wrap-up, as we always do, and then we've listed under the, you know, sort of reorganize it under seven categories, all the top stories. So in part one, we're talking about the economy and financial markets and geopolitics. And usually you and I run through all the different trends and stories. We're not going to do that this time.
Right.
Because last night we had a very deep, really productive conversation and realized there's some things that are so important. We just have to focus on what's very, very important. And I said, look, these are things to a certain extent I've said many times before, but in traveling and talking to subscribers, what I'm really, it's not really getting into their spirit.
Right.
So I don't care how redundant it is. We're going to repeat ourselves and we're going to go deeper because there's certain things about this environment that we really need to understand.
Yeah, we need to look at certain things from several different perspectives. Right. And I think that's what we're going to try and do.
Okay. Okay, well, the first thing I wanted to bring up was, it's really funny, I came in and you said we have to really hammer on the Constitution.
Absolutely.
And I was thrilled because that's what I've been doing all quarter long, and I don't think it's sunk in yet.
No, I don't think people, what I do think people sense is the confusion. We've had, since the election, we've seen what I think is kind of a revival of Weimar Germany. And by that, I mean everybody is creating their private armies for, you know, Antifa and Black Lives Matter and all of these different groups, basically to go out and cause violence and wreak chaos and push a particular political agenda. But this really reached ahead for me, as I think it probably did for most people, during the Charlottesville mess.
Right.
And what really became evident to me is in the aftermath of Charlottesville, then you had this sudden attack on American history and culture in the form of, well, let's tear down all these Confederate generals and so on. But now, and this has even reached where I live and probably where you live, now they're going after names of schools, and they're not limiting this anymore to leaders of the Confederacy. Now we're seeing people like Washington, Madison coming under attack, wanting to rename schools. Now, to me, what this whole agenda is it's the ultimate purpose of this is to get rid of the Constitution.
Right.
Because what they're going to do is they're going to say, well, this was a Constitution created by a bunch of white males, landed property owners, and so on and so forth. And they're going to say the Constitution is no longer reflective of our modern values.
Right.
And we need to get a new
one. And our modern technology.
And our modern technology. And all of the
It's out of date. It's old.
It's out of date.
It's old.
It's part of a bygone era, and so on and so forth. So behind all of this culture war, the culture war is being used, I think, to drive an agenda.
Right.
And the agenda is anti-Constitution.
Right.
And again, I'll say it, I've said it before, you and I have discussed this before, you turn over a constitutional convention to this current political class and this current popular culture, which does not understand these things,
right,
and you're going to get a real mess.
Right.
You're no longer going to have the constitutional protections that you have.
Right.
So to me, this is a cultural agenda that is driving a political agenda.
So here's I think, one of the things I've seen in the last 2 months and really come to appreciate. Because, you know, I flew all the way to Bangladesh just to do an interview with Cynthia McKinney. Because Cynthia, having been at war, I mean, if you look at who's pushing the cultural war,
yes,
that's the group she did war with, what she calls the Ziacons.
Yes.
And you know, they threw her out, she got back in, they threw her out again, and she's been fearless in warring with them.
Right.
And she knows them, and she understands them. And so I flew all the way to Bangladesh just to sit down with her, because before I did an interview with her, we needed to talk.
Right.
We talked for a week before we did the interview, you know, just what do we do, how do we do it? And then I wrote something called How to Enforce the Constitution, and that's all up available public on the web. But what I discovered was, and this is what she and I talked a lot about when we were just talking before the interview, and that is the American people have lived their entire lives under the umbrella
Yes.
of the protection of the Constitution.
Right.
And even though it's been disrespected, even though it's been eroded, even though they've played all these games with national security, we have no concept of what it would be like if it wasn't there.
Absolutely.
We've lived our entire lives under the umbrella, and we can't fathom what it's like when the umbrella comes down.
No, we can't.
Now, I can, because I've lived outside. You know, to a certain extent, you've lived outside. We can envision it. But most Americans have no idea, despite all the erosion, what an obstacle it is for these folks.
Yeah, it's an obstacle, and it's important, I think, for people to understand why. So long as it is there as a governing document, a governing compact, so long as it's there, there are a certain segment of people in the government, there are a certain segment of people in society, there's a certain segment of people in various corporations that are going to be obedient to it in a sincere fashion.
Right.
Remove that and put in something else that's concocted by social justice warriors, Antifa, and so on, to, so to speak, update the Constitution. Remove that and all of those protections disappear.
Right.
And the people...
And that includes the right to own property.
And that, yes, precisely. That includes the right to own property. If you remove that, you know, one of the things the framers of the Constitution did in order to insist upon a continuation of the sovereignty of this nation was there is a clause in the Constitution that all of the debts incurred under the Articles of Confederacy would still be acknowledged under the new Constitution.
Right.
So in other words, the Constitution, in that sense, did preserve the connection to the old Articles. Now, I'm a fan of the Articles. I'm not a big fan of the current Constitution, but I am adamant that getting rid of this would be far, far worse. You know, I hear libertarians say, well, the Constitution is the root of many of the problems. That may be. But you don't want to get rid of the final thing that offers protections to our basic rights. And if the government continued to acknowledge the debt, it continued to acknowledge the principle of property. What we see now in terms of the social justice warriors, and I've spoken about this before at some of your events, what we see now in terms of the social justice warriors is the application of cultural Marxist tactics in order to achieve a political agenda, and that agenda is precisely to overturn the Constitution. So you could lose your property rights, and at the same time, it would allow the people that have driven these debts and driven the financial mess that we're in to escape any responsibility. And you've raised that issue
so many times. So here's why I think the libertarians are all wet.
Oh, I think
so,
too.
When they say the Constitution is a problem, it's all wet. We have not enforced the Constitution.
That's the big problem.
And if you look at the source of the problems, it's the absence of enforcement.
Yes.
So I've always said crime that pays is crime that stays.
Absolutely.
The missing money, thanks to Dr. Mark Skidmore and his team from Michigan State University, the missing money, as documented on our website with government documents from two agencies, remember, there are 21 covered agencies, two of those agencies, which I suspect are the worst, but I don't know that. We haven't checked the other 19, have $21 trillion mm-hmm. of missing money.
That's obscene.
$21 trillion. That is $1 trillion more than the total debt of the United States. Now, I appreciate that an undocumentable adjustment does not represent cash. But I also would say if you refuse since 1996 to produce audited financial statements as required by law, your financials are meaningless.
Exactly.
Okay. You're a liar, you're a criminal enterprise,
right.
Nothing. Now, if you simply sat down, and this is what Congresswoman McKinney and I talked about, if you simply sit down and enforced Articles, the Appropriation Clause and the War Clause of Article 1 of the Constitution.
Right.
So Article 1 in the War Clause says Congress has to authorize each war.
Yes.
Now, we put into place a blanket authorization after 9/11 that basically said, okay, you can run around the world and kill anybody and do whatever you want, including using drones to assassinate people who've had no due process, including American citizens.
Yeah, so they've set up a star chamber.
Right. So they've set up a global star chamber.
Yes.
Where Congress is authored, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
In violation of the Constitution.
Right.
The second thing they've done is they've said, okay, and this started in fiscal 1998, you can spend as much money as you want, whatever you want. You can issue as much fraudulent securities as you want.
Yep.
In defiance of the appropriation clause that says Congress has to appropriate it for it to be spent and says you have to report You have to provide disclosure from time to time. Mm-hmm. So I would say that if you look at the libertarians, I would say those two things, the failure to enforce those two things is the source of most problems.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would definitely agree with that.
You and I could sit down with people that we totally disagree with on almost every issue. But if they will just agree that the money has to be spent honestly and has to be disclosed, you know, most problems are going to go away.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the libertarians get too involved in philosophical discussions and are not really looking at the reality of the situation.
I think most libertarians are terrified to look at reality.
I think
so they go around in circles because they don't want to face the fact that they're scaredy cats.
No, they don't. And it what they're offering doesn't really address the situation. The situation is, you know, it may be a flawed document. I think it is. But the problem is, flaws or no flaws, it does have protections, and it does have an aspect of covenant that is not being observed. And when it's not observed, we see the mess that results.
Right. So my attitude is enforce the Constitution.
Enforce it. Yeah, absolutely.
After you finish enforcing it, you know, if you don't like it, then we can discuss improving it.
Right.
But until you're willing to enforce the things that we like.
I wouldn't even say I would be willing to discuss improving the Constitution because, again, this takes us back to what I think the fundamental problem is. We're in a culture where the political class itself has no real grounding in the conventions of law and jurisprudence that led to the Constitution.
Right, they don't believe in it.
And secondly, we've got a popular culture that, regardless of what document such a convention might produce, they'll spin it so it sounds good, and people will be stampeded into accepting something that really is not a workable document. So I think the culture has to change, and it has to change, if I can be blunt, in a traditional direction before we even contemplate touching the document and touching the system of government.
Well, right now, the Constitution represents a covenant that we all share and agree to.
Right.
And the reality is, if you tear it down, there will be no new...
There won't be any new... Yeah.
There won't be. What there will be is...
Chaos.
And there will be the ability of the people who stole all the money to buy everything for pennies on the dollar.
Yep.
So, one of the things we're doing in the third quarter wrap-up is we're going to talk about Control 101. That's our theme.
And
You know what? Our cover is very clever. I love the... You know, and we get into all the gruesome stuff. Entrainment, whether warfare, false flags, everything. And it's funny because for many, many years, as you know, in the financial community, I've been saying it's going to slow burn. And you have an entire alternative financial media that says, no, it's going to collapse. I said, no, it's not. It's going to slow burn.
Right.
And the difference between them and me is I understand the control technologies. I understand how you can manipulate the stock market or the bond market, because I know how you can manipulate all the different people involved.
Right.
And I have literally found myself in constant war with the alternative media world, the financial media, for 15 years. And so one of the things that amazes me is they will say it's all going to implode in July. And the dollar's going to go to zero in July.
In July.
And then in July, the dollar goes up.
Yeah.
You know, and so this war goes on and on and on. Very few people, one of the few people who ever came back to me and said, you know, something, you were right and I was wrong. I want to learn more about what you have to say and why. That was Greg Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
I sat on his show and he said, look, it was coming into July, July 2014, I think. And Foster and Kimberly Gamble, who were dear friends at the time, I went out to their house and they said, look, the dollar's going to collapse in July. I said, no, it's not. It's going to explode. It's very strong. They said, no, it's going to collapse. I said, guys, you know, if you're going to say that, a lot of people could lose money listening to you. So I'm just going to have to part company with you publicly over this. And it got tense because, you know, what they were saying was just dead wrong.
Right.
And so I got on Greg Hunter's show that month. I'll never forget it. So I leave Foster and Kimberly's house. I go get on with Greg Hunter, and Greg Hunter says the dollar's going to collapse. I said, no, it's not. It's going to explode. It's going to go up. It could go up a lot. And it turned out by the end of the year, it was up 30%, which is a huge move in the currency markets. So Greg said to me, and he got very upset. He's a very passionate guy. You know, I love him to pieces for it. And he says, you don't understand. Every person on this show You know, he's got a lot of people. Every person says it's going to collapse, and it's going to collapse soon. It's going to collapse this year. Every person. You're the only one who says it's going to go up. And he said, so you have to be wrong. I said, no, I'm right. So he bet me a dollar. And I made him pay me the dollar. It's framed in my office. And he came back to me and he said, how could everybody be wrong and you be right? And I said, Greg, it's because I understand control technologies. Because as a result of the litigation, I had the opportunity to learn how a few people controlled this many people enough to literally make things go up that have no value.
Right.
You know, and part of it is you have to understand how they use the federal credit mechanism. Because if I can engineer the federal credit mechanism with all of its securities and all of its money and all of its cash flows and all of its credit flows and make it do things that are highly contradictory to fundamental economics, and I can do it for a long, long time.
Yep.
You know, and I have these control technologies that I can do what they're doing.
Yep.
And, you know, I would never have believed it. When I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, I would never have believed it possible if I hadn't drilled down to the control technologies. So every time since then, I sit down with most financial professionals. I say, okay, let's talk about the control technologies. So off we go, and suddenly I bring up the first one, like pedophilia and control files, and they're like, I don't want to go there.
Yep.
I said, how can you not go there? How can you not? How can you recommend to other people that they invest their money in a system when you won't really take the time to understand the mechanics of the system? So then the next one is, you know, I try and explain how you can do surveillance capitalism using software and AI. So the NSA doesn't need a million people listening to all of us. They can do it all with software and AI.
That's right.
And they say, I don't want to go there.
Yeah.
So I've had a couple of years of, I don't want to go there. And there's a state of denial. One of the things on the missing money is, I don't want to go there. It's too big. It's too overwhelming. There's a state of denial about looking at the nuts and bolts.
Yes.
Of what we're dealing with. And to me, if we want to stay alive, if we want to protect the Constitution, we have to go there.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, the reason I'm saying this to you is one of the reasons that I'm always wanting to record these sessions with you is you're willing to go there.
Yeah.
So where the hell did you get the courage?
Well, I look at it, frankly, it comes partially from academic experience when I was in academia, and partially it comes from the fact that, you know, I'm a victim of all of these wonderful social programs and
right.
faulty market analysis. The bottom line is that economics as an academic subject does not teach you to look at these human mechanisms.
Right.
And that's the big problem, because we've discussed this before, the influence of technology on market manipulation.
It's fantastic.
It's astronomical at right. this stage. So this means, in effect, just if, you know, laying aside all of the other stuff, laying aside control files, blackmail, and all of the other things that are part of this system, if you look just simply at the impact of technology on markets, what we have now are equities markets, commodities markets. I would even go so far as to say bond markets and everything.
It's all managed.
And most of the trading is being done by computer algorithms
right.
that even the programmers themselves half the time don't understand.
Right.
So we're living in kind of a parallel track world as far as I'm concerned, as far as the public financial system goes. And those two systems we're living partly in a virtual system where prices are no longer reflective of a human reality.
Right.
In other words, when I think of Wall Street, you know, I grew up in the 60s.
It's virtual reality.
It's virtual reality.
Right. And it doesn't reflect the analog world.
It does not. Yes, precisely. Right. It does not reflect any actual human trading that's going on. So what this means in turn, let's drill down to the brass tacks, because you mentioned this last night, and I wanted to make a point of bringing this up. What this means is that price is no longer a signal mm-hmm. of actual value. It's no longer a signal of actual
reality.
productive reality.
Right.
It's a completely artificial world.
Right.
And that, you cannot have a functioning economy over the long term if that is the basis, because right. you're leaving out the screaming traders on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange waving papers around and getting right. them punched and mailing out stock certificates at the end of the day. That world is gone, by and large. And that's the world I think, frankly, needs to come back,
right.
because that's a world that's reflective of real human market conditions. What we're living in now is make-believe,
right.
quite frankly. It's nothing but make-believe. And if you can't understand the markets, it's because the markets are no longer reflective of that human reality.
Well, but here's the little nasty secret here. You can only do that. You can only replace some markets with interventions.
Right, you know, exactly.
So
bingo.
So there's no market, there's just interventions.
A bingo.
You can only do that if you control the federal credit mechanism and can right. have access to an infinite amount of money
right.
to rig things.
Right, exactly.
Okay? You have to have that plug. Because if you don't have that plug, then the tail, in the worst case, is your private equity.
Now, you said something very crucial, and I hope people really latched onto it. You have access to an infinite amount of money. So in other words, the standard models that you and I would be familiar with from economics class in high school or college or whatever, those models simply no longer apply. They're not operating with these models anymore.
Right.
They're operating with models of infinite money, infinite debt, and so on and so
right.
forth. I tried to bring that out in Babylon's Banksters. The other thing that I think is a crucial component of what people need to latch on to here with all of this technology and the ability to have a system of constant intervention in the markets, which is what we're looking at,
right.
bottom line.
Right.
This, I think, is coming out of certain studies that were done at the same time that we saw the change in the financial markets really begin to take hold and a deep grip, which was, I think, around the mid-1990s. The other thing that happened at the same time was the military-industrial complex, the intelligence complex in this country, came up with the idea of full-spectrum dominance.
Right.
And what that means is we want to control everything.
Right.
We want to control the information. We want to control the weather. We
right.
want to control space. We want to control the schools. We want to control, you know, the textbooks. And this is the system they've put into place.
Well, they're putting it into
and,
place.
And yes, they're putting it into right. place. You know, I view all of this as, I view Common Core, I view the vaccine issue, I view GMOs. I view all of this as coming out of that determination by certain powerful individuals in the deep state to implement this sort of full-spectrum dominance. They want, quite literally, to turn us all into slaves, and technology is the way they're going to try and do it. So it should come as no surprise
right.
if we look back at the markets from that point of view, that what they're going to be setting up is a system, as you say, of constant intervention. This is exactly what we're looking at. It's constant
right.
intervention everywhere.
To control markets, you need to control people.
Yes.
One at a time.
Bingo.
And that's how they're doing it.
That's how they're going
right.
to do it.
And you need to make the economics work, you need to harvest people one at a time.
Yep.
Now, the reason I keep hammering on the Constitution is that's their biggest obstacle.
That's their biggest obstacle.
That's their biggest obstacle. And they are trying many different roads to try and tear it up or bring it down.
Right.
One of the reasons they are so, they feel a real urgency to do so is they don't want to pay the $21 trillion back.
Right. They're liable for it.
They're liable. Under the Constitution, we have a legal mechanism to get that money back.
Right.
So I'll give you an example. I litigated, as you know, for 10, 11 years with the federal government over an issue. One of the issues was they asserted the right to seize $2.3 trillion of money owed to my company. They asserted the seizure of that money with a common law right of offset.
Right.
and they asserted that if a loan sale on which we had made them a fantastic amount of profit,
mm-hmm.
if something else had happened we might have made $2.3 million. So it was a theoretical opportunity cost. It was not cash.
Right.
Okay. So we're not even talking about cash here. We're talking about a theoretical opportunity cost, like right. $21 trillion of undocumentable adjustments. And they asserted a common law right of offset to grab $2.3 million of our cash to offset against a theoretical opportunity cost. Now, if you take that theory,
yes,
the federal government has the right to assert a common law right of offset against the New York Fed, the New York Fed member banks, the San Francisco Fed, and the San Francisco member banks, because they have transacted $21 trillion of illegal transactions intentionally, knowledgeably.
Right.
Okay, as have the different defense contractors who run those payment systems. So people say, well, we could never get that back. Of course we can get it back. If you have a legal mechanism,
right.
all you have to do is assert a common law right of offset.
Right, exactly.
Right.
And that's, you remove the Constitution. This is why I'm so skeptical of all of this, because go back again to the Constitution and what it said about the debts incurred by the government under the previous constitutional system, under the Articles of Confederation. All of those were to be carried over.
Right.
A constitutional convention could conceivably wipe all that off the books,
right.
just simply walk away from it all.
Right.
And in the process of walking away from it all, strip everybody of their property rights,
right.
and leave every one of us, you know, under the gun to the people that committed the crime in the first place. So,
right.
yeah. This is all interconnected, and I hope that's what people take away from all of this.
Well, you know, that's why we had the cartoon in the second quarter
yeah.
wrap-up, because I wanted to make, like, a comic book of this. You know, the financial coup is not over.
No,
you've stolen, you know, whether it was the internet pump and dump or the missing money. So you got $27 trillion or some amount of money on the bailouts. You got you know, the $21 trillion of missing money. You've got the pump and dump of the tech market and some other things. So
right.
let's say we'll just call it $50 trillion. You've got the $50 trillion, but you still have the liabilities. The liabilities,
yep.
if you look at the liabilities on the government balance sheet, whether it's the debt or all the different commitments, you've got your liability to the trust fund, because the trust fund is not a government entitlement or benefit. The Social Security Trust Fund represents money paid in. It belongs to them. And you know, what's sitting there is an asset, which is a debt of the U.S. government. So you've got military pension funds.
Yep.
You've got food stamps. You've got all these commitments
yep.
you've made. And so if you can tear up those commitments,
yep.
you double your profit.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like winning the lottery twice.
Yep.
So you've stolen $50 trillion. But you need to tear up $50 trillion of liabilities if you're going to get away with the assets. And then you want to be able to just do whatever you want to manage the people. Because if you look at, you know, if you look at the corporate stocks and the Fortune 500, they've been going up steadily. You know, from 1955 to 1995, they tracked with the GNP. But since then,
yep.
they've grown fantastically faster. And the reality is they can't keep doing that without literally starting to strip and steal
yep.
very directly and boldly. I mean, it's been
yep.
going on quietly and covertly. Now you have to get out front. So now you're talking about significant social and political reengineering. But if you look at where they want to go in terms of chipping people and making money digital,
yep.
this is why they want to get rid of cash.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Because without cash... Number one, with cash, you have privacy, you have a measure of privacy, you have a measure of sovereignty. Without cash, you're dealing essentially, and we'll probably be getting back to this in part two.
Right.
But without cash, you're dealing essentially with a system that has no oversight.
Right.
That is being run by the very same people that have robbed us blind already.
Right. So let's look at the profit. I steal $50 trillion. To make that $50 trillion worth a lot, I tear up my obligations, my $50 trillion of obligations. And then when I do that, I implode the economy so I can turn around and buy everything else on pennies
on the dollar.
And yep. then it's a triple play.
Yep.
yep. What do they call it in the lottery when you get it, when you hit a triple play?
They call it fraud.
Well, I think for many people, it's hard to imagine that someone would have the hubris to do this.
It's not, yeah, I think the average person on the street just thinks that that's just too gargantuan to be able to pull off. But, you know, these people, they've documented all of this. They've told us about the missing money. They've told us about these adjustments in the federal budget, and it's reached the stage now of trillions of dollars, more than the gross domestic product of the United States.
No, more than the outstanding debt.
More than the outstanding debt of the United States. But even there, again, let's go back to the bailouts when we found out that there were, what, 14 to 17 quadrillion dollars worth of derivatives sloshing around in the system. That's in excess, I think, some 15 to 16 times the gross domestic product of the planet.
Right.
Now, that takes an extraordinary amount of hubris. So they've documented their own inability to deal with reality. They've documented their own willingness to go to the mat and enslave everybody. So this should not be a problem for people to wrap their heads around.
Right.
This is clear. It's documented. So the problem for me, ultimately, is you're dealing with people that have networked sufficiently that they now control all the levers and mechanisms through control files, mind manipulation. Weather derivatives is the latest thing to come on the scene, which is a handy thing to have around if you've got the technology to manipulate the weather. I've said this many times. Right. You're dealing with people that are literally playing with and for the entire planet.
Right.
And there's no doubt in my mind that the last thing that they want is a mechanism in the form of a system of governance, namely the Constitution, that recognizes the sovereignty of the individual over their papers, person, and property, and their life. This is the last thing they want.
Right.
Because that holds them accountable.
Right.
Because they're under that umbrella, too. Take that umbrella away, as you say, and you ain't seen nothing. We are in for bad, bad times if they get away with that agenda. And what disturbs me, too, is we've seen the creation. I call it the Weimar Republic. We're living in the Weimar Republic where you have private armies now creating social chaos. Most of this is coming from the left. Eventually, this will happen on the right as well. And that's when things degenerate into chaos. And at that point, we're going to see either calls for a constitutional convention or we're going to see calls for a strong arm, a strong individual to come in and, quote-unquote, restore law and order. This profoundly disturbs me. We need to remember the Reichstag fire. The Constitution issue, to me, is this country's Reichstag fire.
Right.
This is where they're going to make their big play.
Right. And that's why I'm so concerned about the weaponization of the population.
This is precisely what's going on. Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
And I haven't seen the new Kingsman movie out. So I've had several people call me and say, oh, my God, I can't talk to you about it, but you need to go see it. But I see lots of different signs that they're prototyping that.
Oh, yes.
Around. And what was scary to me, I talked to you about the conference that Harry Blaser and I just attended. And Harry and I are going to record a report and explain it in a lot more detail. You and I are going to touch on some of the things I learned. But there was a wonderful young woman there who was talking about how divided we were as a people because you had these wonderful citizens showing up in black hoods and breaking windows and being violent. And I realized she has no idea it's an op. They're not. These people are paid.
Yeah.
It's funny, Franklin on our interview on the Precious Metals Market Report said, yeah, people don't have time to leave their jobs, drive 1,000 miles to break windows. You know, they're too busy for that.
Well, I read a report recently that Hillary Clinton during the campaign had donated, I think, $800,000 from her campaign fund to Antifa.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, I mean, that says it all right there, folks. This is a put-up job with professional paid actors, with agents provocateurs, probably from various rogue elements within the intelligence community. And like I say, it's only a matter of time. If that part of political society is willing to do that, then there's eventually going to be a pushback of a similar nature. And once that happens, things degenerate into chaos. You create a constitutional crisis, so you're either going to solve it with a constitutional convention, which is going to be a disaster. Again, I just point out to people, do you want Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton, Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell being the people to draw up a new constitution for the country.
Well, they're not going to be the ones to draw. Well, that's going to be somebody much more terrifying.
Yeah, much more terrifying than them, but I'm using them because they're
present. Right, but now we're talking, you know, all those crazy people on the internet who say they're going to round us up and put us in FEMA camps.
Hmm.
You know, everybody poo-poos it, and I poo-poo it. Well, that stuff's going to happen.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It's either going to be that or it's going to be the call for a strongman to restore law and order.
Well, one of the things that happened at the conference was I heard plan B about how we get rid of the Constitution. So one of the plans to get rid of the Constitution is to do the CONCON, and that's working the state legislators and trying to get them to pass a request for a CONCON. You get there, and then, of course, everybody's entrained, and then you tear it up and you know, do something new. And I have a great interview with Edwin Vieira where he explains why you can't limit a constitutional convention. Once you start it, it'll be out of control. Okay.
Yep.
So that's great. So that's one pathway to it. And you that one is coming from conservatives, but there's also been several liberal attempts.
Sure.
You know, and it has to do with climate change or save the, you know, there are different angles they've tried. It's like they're trying everything. But I saw an activist who's being financed anonymously through Bitcoin. Bitcoin is giving the powers that be the ability to launder infinite amounts of money into activist pockets and all these people on an anonymous basis.
Yep.
Now, it's not anonymous, in my opinion, to the NSA, but,
sure.
You know, other than that. And what he said was as follows, and it's up on his website, but what he said is, first, you know, the libertarians win, and the first thing we do by executive order is we shut down the government. The second thing we do is we put all the assets in a trust fund and then we privatize them.
Yeah. Russia 2.0.
And we tear up the Constitution because it's old and passe and we don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
So I stood up and I said, well, it's very interesting you bring up this plan because this plan has been tried once before.
Uh-huh.
Actually, it's been tried several times before. Greg Palast has documented how it was tried in Latin America, but Ann Williamson for the Wall Street Journal documented how it was done in Russia. It's called the Rape of Russia.
Yep.
And in a population of approximately 145 million, it's estimated that 10 to 25 million died.
Yep.
This is financial genocide.
Yes.
Because what you're going to do when you implode the government on the first day is you're going to stop 50% of the cash flows in every county in America. They're just going to stop.
Yes.
And that means they have 1 to 3 weeks of food. Maybe they have 1 to 3 weeks of cash. And that means they can go without 1 to 3 weeks without food. So that maybe they got 9 weeks before they start dying.
Yeah.
And that means that you'll have to sell, the whole economy will implode, and you can sell all the national forest lands and all the lands and all the assets for pennies on the dollar.
Interstates, highways, everything. Airports, everything. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And you're going to have if you have 10 to 25 million people in Russia, you're going to have 30 to 75 million people in the United States.
Yep. Yeah. I agree. That's exactly what they're up to. When you told me that last night, I thought, you know, they did the test run in Russia. It was successful for a certain period until the KGB put a stop to it,
right.
You know, and brought in Mr. Putin.
Right.
Which is why they so hate him, is, you know, he put an end to the looting of Russia. That's really what it was all about.
Right.
Or at least he put the looters back in the hands of Russians
It's interesting. I watch Stone's Putin interviews, which I think is one of the most interesting videos to come out in the third quarter. And what you see by watching all of them, it's long, it's about 4 hours, is that what Putin's success with the economy, which has been much better than I would thought it was possible,
mm-hmm.
has been his ability as both intelligence officer and attorney.
Yes, bingo.
To use the law and ensure that law exists and is respected.
And,
because no economy can function without that. And that's one of the problems with our economy and why it's requiring so much massive subsidy from the federal credit mechanism, because without law, everything is...
Yeah, if you don't have a system that's grounded in good faith and trust and goodwill and good behavior and morality, then the economy breaks down.
Well, if nobody respects contracts, time,
bingo.
Productivity is destroyed.
Yeah, bingo. That's the problem.
Right.
And he's restored that to a certain extent in Russia. And that's what the criminal class in the West does not want to see happen here, because, you know, their game is over at that point. All the money they've stolen is back on the table for discussion, which I am in total agreement with you. This needs to be put on the table, and the Constitution is the only thing that permits it to be put on the table. That's why they've got to get rid of it.
Well, I think there are a couple of tensions here happening at once that are playing around both the Constitution and the missing money. One is that within the population, there's about 5 to 10% of the people who are finally beginning to see, you know, they're finally beginning to get the map.
Right.
They're finally beginning to get the intelligence and see it. I think one of the reasons they did Charlottesville was to make those people feel bad about themselves and give up.
Right.
Okay. They don't want that 5 to 10% to connect up and get together and start to take action. So I think that has been an important dynamic. They're worried. And it's interesting because I have been promoting and trying to warn people about the missing money. In 1999, I started to speak publicly, radio shows, writing about,
right, I remember,
warning them about the housing bubble, the fraudulent securities, and the missing money. So the bailout happens, and then more and more servicing fraud came out on the mortgage. And finally, about 2012, people started to understand what I was saying about the housing bubble, which is a little late, but some people got it and sold their houses right before the high, so that was good. But no one, with very rare exception, has ever been able to resonate or connect with the missing money story. And what I've said, look, if I can steal all the money I want from the federal credit mechanism, then I control.
Right.
You know, and so this is about governance.
Yes.
So if a group of people can steal as much as they want and act with impunity outside the law, then they control. And all these other debates about policy and everything else are irrelevant.
So we had
a congressman who was moving on a series of different issues, including pedophilia and human trafficking. You know, but he and his group had threatened to not reauthorize the NSA bulk collection,
right,
which I suspect was the real issue, not the pedophilia. And, you know, he got shot, and we'll see if he, you know, it looks like he may be harmed for life very seriously. So you've got a whole world of congresspeople, congress critters, and senators, you know, they don't want to get shot.
Exactly.
Right. So, you know, they're kowtowing and they're playing the line. Anyway, so we know one of the big control mechanisms that was put into place was Obamacare.
Yes.
And yet we haven't been able to repeal it.
No. And that to me is a sign of how deep all of this goes. You know, we heard from that particular political party that, you know, just put us into office, you know, give us the Senate, give us the House, give us the White House, and we'll repeal. Well, we've seen that that has gone up in smoke.
Right. And John McCain has been in the lead of making sure it doesn't repeal.
Right. Right. And this brings up this whole control mechanism again, because they're either doing this because they're under threat from the corrupt system, or they're doing it because they have bought into the system and have profited from it. So it is absolutely crucial to understand that these people are not abiding by the Constitution.
Right.
This is the bottom line once again.
Well, here's another thing. If you look at the system, it can't work economically.
It can't work economically, and it's not working at a human level. Let's remember, Obamacare was under threat from suits that were pending before the Supreme Court, and then Justice Roberts flip-flopped. And I've always thought that this was a clear indication that there's some control mechanism
right.
that is being used to ensure that this system does not collapse.
Right.
Which is going to, I mean, you know, plain economics, it's going to. But that's an indicator of how deeply all of this goes and how corrupt this whole system is and how non-constitutional it is.
Back to my stock market chart. If you look at the financial charts that we have for the third quarter, you know, we put up the charts that cover how the different markets have done. What you'll see is the bond market's outperforming the GNP. The stock market's outperforming the GNP. Precious metals is outperforming the GNP. Commodities is not outperforming the GNP. It's equities, bonds, precious metals, everything but commodities is outperforming the GNP. And now part of that can happen because technology is making a difference in certain kinds of productivity, but we know general productivity is flatline, labor productivity is flatline. So that can only be possible if you're liquidating living things.
Yes.
People, environment, you know, and you're stealing massive amounts of money from the federal government to keep it going.
And constant interventions.
Right. So you can't keep that going unless you bust the Constitution.
Yeah.
So we've got a leadership, whether it's corporate or political, because the politicians are getting all their contributions from the capital gains coming off the rising real estate and stock market values. So you can't keep that going without tearing up the Constitution at some point. Right.
Right. That's the problem. And the only thing, and you said it last night, the only thing that can possibly keep it going is tyranny.
Right.
That's the only thing that can keep it going.
For a short time.
For a short time.
Right. But essentially what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to, and this is their vision, you're going to have to replace all labor with software and AI and robotics. And then you're going to have to depopulate the people, or you're going to have to give them a universal income, a chip in their arm, and, you know, go to a cashless
society.
Bingo,
ding, ding, ding.
Right. But if you look at what's happening, the reason healthcare costs are exploding is because you're basically poisoning the population to convert them to infertile people.
Yep.
So GMOs, vaccines, spraying, all these things, you're on a long, slow depopulation. And that's making the healthcare expense, that's exploding the healthcare expenses.
Yep.
Because you're also drugging them with pharmaceuticals, you're feeding them GMOs, you're, you know, so you're poisoning the population and you're weakening them and you're making them infertile, but that's exploding your healthcare costs.
And you're poisoning their minds. Let's not forget that.
Right, you're poisoning their minds. And so you're trying to make it possible so they can't see the game and take care, you know, take control of their own healthcare and, you know, because there is a way through, it's not hopeless. I mean, you can deal with this if you can see the game and take control of your own health. So I think the reason McCain voted against the repeal is Obamacare was the infrastructure put in place to manage the liquidation of the population.
Precisely.
Right.
Oh, I totally agree.
You see,
I've always agreed with
that. When you drive around the country, you and I have talked about this before, you see it because it's the equivalent of the Nazi model.
Yes.
But friendly, you know.
Yeah, Rappaport nice
calls
Nazis.
It, he, right, he calls it... He calls it Hotel Auschwitz.
Yeah.
Right.
It is.
It's like
it
a hotel. But in every, during the 90s and the early 2000s, so for the last 15 years, every county has got a brand new hospital or healthcare clinic complex. So brand new healthcare clinic and a brand new prison.
Yep.
And a brand new criminal justice center.
Yep.
Okay. The middle class gets liquidated through the hospitals, and the lower class gets liquidated through the criminal justice system, and both are drug systems.
Yep.
So the middle class is on pharmaceuticals, and the poor people go through, you know, illegal narcotics and go through the criminal justice, but it's the same process.
It's the same process.
It's the same process, and they're making money on both of them.
Yep.
And the lines between the two are nicely calibrated to optimize their profits, both on the pharmaceuticals and the... And the covert cash flows.
And let's not forget the culture part of this.
Right.
Which for me is the biggie. Let's remember the CIA was involved in promoting what? Modern art.
Right.
And certain types of music. So in other words, they've they're trying to produce, and we talked about this last night, and I call it epistemological warfare. They're trying to produce a state of rational incoherence, cognitive dissonance, in just about everybody,
right.
So that you can no longer spot a moral hypocrisy and then act on it.
Right.
This is the bottom line. And they're keeping everybody drugged. They're keeping everybody zombified through television and music and, you know,
well, it's
the whole
really
nine
funny.
Yards.
When I noticed the Criminal Justice Center, and it was popping up in every county, it was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to see...
And the private prisons.
Right. So you do the pharmaceutical liquidation and then you do the narcotics liquidation, and marijuana is a big thing. Interestingly enough, if you talk to the drug dealers where I live, what you discover is that the biggest reason for buying marijuana is you don't have healthcare insurance and it's an alternative painkiller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
That's right. So, you know, it's so carefully calibrated, but, what was I going to tell you about this? I lost my place.
Well, it's a measure. You know, I knew somebody that had a prescription for medical marijuana, the little pills.
Uh-huh.
And took it for pain and for appetite control, you know, right, to help the appetite. The prescription cost the government $1,700 for a bottle of 30 little pills.
Right.
When he could go out and buy a bag of marijuana for $50.
Yeah, but then a local farmer would make money.
Yeah, bingo. We don't want that.
So here's what I was going to tell you. So I'm watching the criminal justice centers go up and the shiny new hospitals go up. And in the meantime, when you go in the grocery stores, they are significantly expanding the pharmaceutical and off-the-shelf drug section.
Yep.
You know, by a lot, by 10 or 20% of the space. In fact, there was one time when an entire checkout line at the local Walmart was moved aside so they could put in a special vaccine place where people could come and get their vaccines.
Oh, jeez.
You know, and also I went into one CVS or Walgreens, one big, you know, one of these chain stores in California, and they said 10% off all purchases if you'll get the new vaccine.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
I can.
Yeah. So I'm watching, and it's clear that the publicly traded stocks, whether food companies or drug companies, are planning on big profits from this drug push.
Yep.
And I said, I was talking to somebody the other day who said, you're not going to believe this. They never go to the doctor. They're their own doctor. And but for some reason, they went to the doctor. I think it was to get a form for insurance. And the doctor said, how many pharmaceuticals are you taking? And they said, none. And the doctor wrote down nine. And they said, no, not nine, none.
Zero.
Zero. And the doctor was shocked.
Yeah.
But was not shocked by nine. Nine was the appropriate expected answer. Can you imagine taking nine pharmaceuticals?
Well, yeah, I can. Because, again, part of creating the cultural dissonance and breakdown has been to drug kids now. We've seen this, you know, the vaxism-autism connection that they are in absolute denial of. That's part of it. And the other part of it is, you know, giving kids Ritalin and Adderall.
Right.
Particularly young boys, you know.
You know, retired teachers in Tennessee have reported to me that one of the reasons they retired is they were so heavily pressured by the parents to put the kids on drugs so that they could get a Social Security disability check, because otherwise they couldn't afford to feed their kids.
Yeah. Yeah. It's insanity. It's insanity. But it's an engine. The important thing for people to take away from this is that what we're saying is that none of these things are happening by accident. Right. These are coordinated efforts, and I'm going back to what I said earlier about full spectrum dominance. This is not, in my opinion, just a military policy and doctrine. This is the policy that they've adopted for domestic governance and management.
Right, and it depends on a lie.
It depends on a lie.
And one of the lies is that there's no money.
Right.
Okay, and the reason that lie is just ya-ya, you know, I used it before, I'm going to keep using it again. I say it's like a farmer who's got a milk can that's got a hole in the bottom.
Yes.
So if you milk the cow and you put the milk in the can, you never have enough milk because it's always running out of the hole.
Out of the bottom. Mm-hmm.
And the solution is not to shoot the farmer and not to shoot
the cow.
This cow's producing milk.
Yes.
The solution is get a new can or plug a hole.
Yeah.
Right. And the reality is our economy is being run for these different things.
Yes.
You know, and you and I have talked about, you know, the earth is a reed and it's being run to get the dividend and we're all being harvested. So, you know, if you could, in theory, turn the returns by place in every county to a positive return on investment instead of a negative return on investment, if you could allow markets to work instead of, and you could allow people, most people can't be productive unless they can get an honest price.
Bingo.
Price is what helps them to understand how to allocate their time, how to allocate their learning, how to allocate their money so they can be productive and get what they want. And if you turn off the price and you turn off the smoke alarm, they're going to act stupid.
Yeah.
Right. So, So if you look at whether it's turning the government money to a positive return, getting back the money stolen, return the governance of our society to something relatively lawful, as it appears Putin may have done, you know, and give people an honest price, then you're back to a productive society.
You're back to a mechanism. And again, it goes back to what we said earlier right. about price and these virtual markets and the constant intervention in the markets. Price is no longer a mechanism that people can use to determine their decisions. So in the absence of that, what do? Well, they shut down.
Right.
And they quit producing because there's too much confusion.
So here's what I would say is one of the greatest enemies of the U.S. Constitution, and that is Silicon Valley and the software industry. We have created a software industry
yep.
which derives pleasure from disruption.
Yes.
Believes it is free to disrupt not just private market functions, but governmental and civic functions.
Yes.
Believes it should be free to do it outside the law. Believes it yep. should be above the law. You know, is perfectly happy to be sneaky and make sure its code is unreadable. And basically is subject to enormous amounts of sort of blackmail and manipulation. And in addition, they think it's all very clever.
Yeah.
Now, the last thing is they are completely and utterly ignorant of their various subsidies. They don't understand that most of their technology was laundered into them.
Yep.
The regulators have left them alone.
Yep.
And they have massive
Bingo.
Capital subsidy.
Bingo.
Massive. Okay. So they're like surfers on a wave. And all they know is they got the wind at their back, and they don't understand they're being used. They're the patsy. They don't see it. You know, I literally have heard top venture capitalists say, hey, I'm in the private markets. I have nothing to do with governments. Like, pal, the government killed, you know, millions of black people to raise capital so that you could have the cheapest cost of capital in the world. Yep. You don't know that? Yep. You don't know that South Central LA got destroyed so that you could have free money?
Yep.
You don't know that? You know, you don't
and they
know,
don't.
You don't know that Area 51, all that technology got laundered into you and your pals. You don't know. Well, these guys are very smart and they've worked very, very hard. They're very ambitious. They're very smart. And they don't know. They're in certain respects, you're looking at people who have an IQ of 180 who are the stupidest people you have ever seen. And it's terrifying.
Well, it's terrifying. And it's because it's not just because they're ignorant of their own subsidized roots. But they're also living in that virtual world themselves. They're helping to create that virtual world.
Right.
So they don't think that they don't have any real connection to human activity. This is the problem. Everything's a virtual reality to them.
Right.
And they don't see the human cost of some of the things that they're doing.
They don't care.
And many of them don't care.
If you can, it's funny, the two books I keep trying to get everyone to read during the third quarter is Tim Wu's The Master Switch.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtitle is The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. And then the other one I'll put up a book review for is Kathy O'Neill's The Weapons of Mass Destruction, mm-hmm. about how software and algorithms are being used to engineer an industry, not reflecting where the market would take it, but
Bingo.
Where you can take it if you can rig it with centralizing software, which is not open source and for which there's no regulation when it's interfering with government.
Precisely.
You know, when it's doing real harm to people. You know, they think if you can basically rape a population of poor people and make money doing it, it's good.
Well, we're going to probably talk about this in part two a little bit,
right.
but the important thing to drive home right now for people to understand is if we have systems of financial clearing and market manipulation being driven by software. Just look at all, and if you think a cashless society would be a wonderful thing, just look at all of the stories of hacking that we've seen come out in, say, the last 3 to 4 years.
Right.
We've had the Federal Reserve has been hacked. We've had Equifax recently. We've had Sony. We've had JP Morgan Chase. Who else? I think there was a story somewhere.
SEC.
The SEC. I think there was a story somewhere about the Bundesbank was hacked.
Certainly the Office of Management and Personnel.
Yeah.
That was frightening.
That was horrid.
Right.
Yeah. In addition to all of this, we've had security breaches at Los Alamos with hackers, a Chinese spy case, and on it goes. These, you've said this so many times, but I'm going to repeat it. These systems are not secure.
Right.
We don't know the extent of backdoors.
Right.
In blockchain technologies, things like Bitcoin and so on and so forth. We don't know the extent of that because, again, there's no oversight. So, yeah, right. We can use Bitcoin to fund our private armies. You know, this is auto fit.
There's the money that they're laundering to activists through Bitcoin is astonishing.
Oh, yeah.
From everything I'm seeing just in...
Yeah, that's Adolf Hitler's wet dream. You know, Create your private armies with anonymous sources of funding.
Right, but they're not selling Adolf Hitler's plan.
They're selling something worse.
No, they're selling. They're saying, let's triple Goldman Sachs' profits.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
Well, the results will be the same. Right. Like you say, it's an anti-human agenda.
Right. When Goldman Sachs came out with their new plan to do retail lending, I thought, why would Goldman Sachs do that? And then after going through how blockchain and cryptocurrencies could basically wipe out 8,000 community banks and 5,000 credit unions, I said, oh.
That's why. Yeah.
There you go.
Exactly. So this stuff, you know, again, folks, this technology stuff is not the boon that they're saying it is, particularly this cashless stuff. No,
especially if you look at all the shadow work. I mean, I really
absolutely
think the software industry is destroying productivity in this country.
Absolutely. Right? Because, I totally agree.
I said at the conference, I said, look, we've got a political system that has no integrity. We have a financial system that has no integrity or has lost a lot of integrity within the political system because the financial system is just a subset of the governance system. And now we've added information systems that have
no integrity.
And how do you think a digital product is going to solve any of those problems?
Yeah, bingo.
Right, because control is analog.
Yeah.
Anyway, before we leave Constitution and the missing money, I want to talk about a couple more things. The administration failed to achieve a repeal of the Obamacare, but the other thing they're now working on is tax reform.
Right.
And the reality is, one of the things that we've seen over the last 2 years, when the price of gold was rising in the early part of the century, we saw the creation of ETFs like GLD and SLV that sucked enormous amounts of money out of the physical market into paper market. And if it hadn't, the gold price would have just skyrocketed. And now we're watching the same thing happen again with cryptocurrencies.
Yep.
You know, it's sucking a huge amount of money out of the physical gold market. And that makes it possible for the smart money, the central banks and the smart money to buy up more gold and buy up land.
On the cheap.
Right. So they're buying up gold, they're buying up land. And that, you know, the Federal Reserve is better off because all the money they've printed can just get soaked up by zeros and ones in cryptocurrency and not compete for the hard assets everybody wants to own and control. Particularly, I think land and gold are sort of at the top of everybody's list. So it's very clever. And if you look, gold is still up more than 10% this year. So gold has, it's amazing how much the price has gone up given this kind of, I call it GLD 2.0. Cryptocurrencies are GLD 2.0. But one of the things that's happening is the president is very committed to getting tax reform.
Right.
One of his dangers is he would like to get tax reform across the board.
Right.
Or simplification, but lowering tax rates for everybody. His danger is what will get through Congress, what will make it through the sausage factory is what's good for the rich.
Yes.
Right. And to a certain extent, once you go into the process, he can't control it anymore.
That's right.
Okay. So his danger is what is great for the rich. But one of the things we know is the U.S. corporations have kept trillions abroad and haven't brought it back because they don't want to pay taxes on it. So the reality is if he engineers it and the Congress engineers it so it can come back, we are going to see a lot of money coming into this country that's going to want to buy everything.
Yes, indeed.
Now, they can get much cheaper prices if they implode the U.S. government.
Bingo.
But I don't necessarily believe they think they're better off doing that because then you have a pretty chaotic situation.
Yeah, and they don't have all the mechanisms in place. In fact, I think certain things like the hacking incidents and some other things that we'll probably talk about in part two have given them the yellow light. to right. slow down, because right. now they're confronted with, quite frankly, what they're confronted with is, I think that they think that there are groups and people, possibly other nations, that have systems that can render ours ineffective and take them down on a very selected, targeted basis. And that means that they, to a certain extent, have lost control of the situation. I don't see them, under such circumstances, risking a full-out implosion. I think that's still going to be part of their game plan, but they've got to slow down the schedule and act much more circumspectly.
Well, if that money comes in, and it, many different things could be going on when it comes in, I think there's a very good chance that they get from Congress two things. One is to repeal the estate tax.
Yeah.
And one is to let that money come back.
Yeah.
Now, they've been trying for about more than a decade to set the United States as the ultimate safe haven.
Right.
Okay. So they did everything they could to shut down Switzerland and get Switzerland under the U.S. thumb. And they've made Nevada, some of the other states,
yes.
really prime locations for offshore money. But here's the thing. If you look, when I was in Hong Kong, the PRC are moving in to really establish their control in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And you have in Asia huge amounts of money, which is very nervous about. But they don't want to come here as long as there's an estate tax.
Yes.
So you have two pressures to get an estate tax. One is you have baby boomers all throughout the heartland. They own farms. They own car washes. They own dry cleaners.
Right.
They want to set their estate up, you know, so that the wealth transitions.
Right.
They need an estate tax. You know, they need no estate taxes because right. they've got maybe the car wash and the land is worth $10 million. And otherwise, they're going to get killed by taxes. So there's pressure from the baby boomers. There's pressure from all the new billionaires. But now you have tremendous pressure from around the world of talent and capital that will come here if those families feel safe from estate taxes.
Right.
Now,
exactly.
I believe as a political, as an economic matter, what is going to really drive is that offshore money.
Oh, I do too.
And in fact, while the repeal of the estate tax could look terribly unfair, we might all be better off for having those people here.
Well,
that's a lot of talent.
There's a strategic and geopolitical military calculation to this too, I think needs to be considered. In terms of a power base,
right.
Mr. Globaloney still is reliant on North America.
Right.
And what they've been doing over the past 20 to 30 years under globalization is they've been farming out too much.
Right.
And now it's caught up to them.
Right.
I mean, right now, I mean, just stop and think about it. We have weapons systems in this country that are produced under license from foreign companies.
Right.
And if you're Mr. Globaloney and you're looking at the hacking incidents and so on and so forth, you realize not only do you need to reshore that money, but in the process, you need to reshore manufacturing of certain key crucial industries
right.
that your operation needs in order to survive.
Right, but to do that, you've got to bring in liquid capital.
Right.
Right.
So I think this is going to happen
right.
under those circumstances. It may not necessarily be of immediate benefit to, you know, the baby boomers, but I suspect it will. The problem that people are going to have to be alerted is this is the same group of people that have stolen all this money to begin with. So, you know, it may look good for a while, but basically my warning here is stay on your toes and keep watching these people, because this is a strategic calculation for them that they've got to do, and they've got to do fast.
Right.
And we're going to get into this, I think, in part two.
Well, you don't want your space program outsourced.
Oh, right. Precisely.
So here's what I think. If they get the tax reform that they want, I think what you're going to get at a minimum is you're going to get the corporate money repatriating.
Right.
And you're going to get wealthy families around the world re-domiciling into the United States.
Oh, I think that I think there's indications this is already happening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the Rothschilds have been buying up land in
right.
this country, in Nevada, if I'm not mistaken. And again, that's something that we'll talk about in part two, is this what I think could be a realignment between the Rockefeller and Rothschild interests. Right now, the Rockefeller interest, which has always been about controlling the technology, and the Rothschilds have always been about controlling land and hard, tangible assets.
Right.
The Rockefeller interest, you know, you brought this up last night.
David's death in March was a major event. Development.
Because the break, the old guard, the conservative attitude towards things is no longer there. The experience
well, you know, the
is
Amazon
no longer
deal
there.
Went forward right after David
dies. Right after he dies. Right, exactly.
And to me, that says, well, that takes us to our next topic, which is accelerating up the S-curve of the shift from global 2.0 to 3.0. When we were in the conference out in Colorado, and thank God Harry Blaser was there. And again, we're going to record a report with him, which we'll publish shortly. You know, you and I invented together, because I remember we were sitting at this very table, the shift from global 2.0 to 3.0.
3.0, right.
And we kind of invented that together and talk about it, have been talking about it for years. But when the Amazon, when Amazon bought Whole Foods, I said, okay, this, the bell just rang, because their stock went up $13 billion and all these other stocks went down $70 billion. So the market shrunk. That's deflation.
Yep.
So this is the bell that David has died, and now they're going to go up the S-curve.
Yep.
Okay, and I'll just stop. I'll be really blunt. If you said to me, who gave the kill order on Kennedy and 9/11, I would have said it was David.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I believe. So, and certainly Talbot, I think, has more than proved that in Devil's Chessboard with respect to the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
Anyway, so his death was a very, very big moment because he appeared to be pretty active up until the end. So I had said all of this many, many times to Harry Blaser, and Harry and I had done a show about Amazon buying Whole Foods where we discussed it. But one of the things you could see diving into what's happening in blockchain and cryptocurrencies and the planned disruption over the next 2 to 5 years, including in the 2020 election, was you could see the speed at which these guys believe we're going to go up the global 3.0 S-curve.
Right.
And Harry said, oh, my God, now I understand what you're saying. And I said, you mean you haven't understood up till now? He said, no, now I really see it and feel it.
Yeah, the brakes are removed.
Perfect. This is why
the foot's no
I
longer
think you're a genius.
No, it's very clear. You had right. really two deaths that removed the foot from the brake pedal.
Right,
and Bush, David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Right, and Bush is now incapacitated, and Cheney essentially out.
Yeah,
right.
So you've got a whole group of young Turks essentially in that segment of the deep state that, number one, they don't have the experience.
Right.
Number two, they're to a certain extent they're much stupider. And much more arrogant.
Well, they're very, very smart. But what they have is they have the fever. And they don't know what they don't know.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. And I think they're the yes men that the old guard surrounded themselves with. And now that the foot is no longer on the brake pedal and they no longer have that sort of realpolitik guidance and experience that's guiding them. And you can see it in our blundering in foreign policy. I mean, it's just all over the place. Now that break is removed, they've got the fever and they're going to run with it. And I think this is part of the problem. I think this is why you're seeing the retrenchment. I think there's a certain segment of that global crowd that realizes they're in a strategic pickle. And you've got an emerging conflict, and I'm going to predict that people watch for this very carefully. You've got an emerging conflict from the people that do realize the strategic mess that they've put themselves in and are going to have to reshore the money, reshore the manufacturing of this country. And then you've got the people with the fever pitch that want to press forward full steam.
Right.
And that's a dangerous mix because this is also playing out in the background of all this other stuff that we see going on. It's a very, very dangerous situation.
The first group understands herd management. The second group has always been living in virtual reality.
Bingo.
They don't understand herd management.
Bingo. Precisely.
Right.
Precisely. And this is going to be, I think, the one of the themes over the next at least 5 years, if not the next decade or so. This is going to play itself out, and it's going to play itself out chiefly in this country. I think to a certain extent you're seeing it playing out in Europe.
Right.
You've got it playing out in terms of the faction behind the Brexit vote, which I would include the royal family with that.
Right.
And then on the other hand, you've got the people living in their virtual reality world. Macron and, you know, the vice chancellor of Europe, as someone once said. And then, you know, Merkel's just been reelected, and clearly she's...
But with a much weaker mandate.
With a much weaker mandate. Yeah. The Alternative for Deutschland party grew, actually, I think, has some 90 seats in the Bundestag. And that's a sign that things are very shaky. And she dismissed Schäuble, one of the few people
which is huge. Which is the end of an era.
Which is the end of an era. Yeah, right. That was a huge, huge move. Because he understood things.
Yes, he did.
And I don't think she does.
I think he's a brilliant, brilliant man.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated. One of the most important books I read this year, and I recommend it to everybody, is the Greek finance minister's book, Adults in the Room. And one of the things you see is, one, the austerity plan is war.
Right.
They don't want Greece's economy to turn around and succeed. They don't want to get paid back. They want to strip the place.
Right.
You know, it is the rape of Russia.
Right.
In a much more sophisticated, subtle plan. And the guy's naivete allows the process to occur, and his ability to record with an iPhone all the conversations basically shows you that. And one of the things you see at the end is that Schäuble is a very ultimately human guy who knows how horrible what is happening is and how wrong it is. And somehow his humanity comes out. And it wouldn't surprise me if that book cost him.
It wouldn't surprise
me. Well, he's going to be running the Bundestag. He's going to be the president of the Bundestag.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see where his career goes from this point. Now that he's no longer officially a part of her cabinet, this puts him in a position, I think, of some strength over the long term.
Yeah, if I were him, I'd much rather be the president of the Bundestag than...
Well, you know, especially under the conditions now that this new parliament is coming in.
Well, but I think austerity may be dead.
Well, it's not only that, but the other long-term thing that I think this presages is, again, we're going back to this, the old guard and the people living in their virtual reality. Well, Merkel's living in her virtual reality.
He's not.
He's smart. If I remember correctly, it was Schäuble, and you pointed this out, I think, about a year ago. It was Schäuble that said that there is no fixing of the financial system that is not a reform.
Right.
And that,
he said
that's
the debt
huge.
Growth model is over.
Yeah, the debt growth
there
model,
there are
right.
no reforms that are not real reforms. And I think, I'm curious, but my guess is he understands that Fortune 500 chart.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Look, we can't keep destroying the economy just to make the stock market go up.
Right, right.
You know, ultimately, this is the issue of the pilot seniority.
Well,
did I ever tell you the pilot seniority story? No. Okay, you go first, and then I'm going to tell you the pilot seniority.
The other thing that we need to remember about Europe, and particularly Merkel's government, is Merkel is coming out of a mentorship from Chancellor Kohl. He was her mentor. Kohl, in turn, the Christian Democratic Union, that party in Germany, was in turn heavily, heavily financed by the German chemicals industry. In other words, the big multinational global corporations over there. So Merkel always looked to me like she was kind of a national globalist sort of person.
Right.
And she's been running Germany and Europe that way, and it's not working.
Right.
So Schäuble's dismissal from the government, to me, indicates there were some real deep philosophical divisions between her and her finance minister. And he's cut himself loose. I would not be a bit surprised to see him start maneuvering for control of the CDU and see him as a candidate that stands against her next time for leadership of the party. That would not surprise me at all, particularly, and I'm not predicting this because I don't know enough about German politics to know whether or not he's going to go this way, But if he's successful in reaching out to the Alternative for Deutschland party and certain elements of the SDP, I mean, you know, where Germany goes, Europe is going to go.
Right.
So he's the guy to watch here. I really do think that there were deep, deep philosophical divisions between him and Merkel. And
what's very interesting about him, if you go back and look at his history from the beginning, this guy understands nuts and bolts.
Yeah, he does. So he does.
This is a guy who can re-engineer the train tracks of power.
Yes.
Because he knows where all the
stuff is.
He knows where all the switches are. He knows where all the lines.
Yep.
This is a guy who's walked the lines.
Yes.
He knows all the lines.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, precisely.
He's a master. He's not only an experienced politician, but he's a master bureaucrat, and he's a master negotiator of financial transactions.
Well, what else? You know, the other thing that it demonstrates or that it shows is that her coalition is very weak, and she's losing her grip on her cabinet. Because he was very outspoken, even as a cabinet minister, as was her foreign minister at the time, Steinmeier. And he, you know, she booted him.
Right.
So in other words, she's completely rearranged her cabinet from the people that were there. And the people that were there were the relatively sane people in the group. Who knows what we've got now?
Right.
We've got Macron. Member of the German cabinet. But no, I'm very serious. So Europe, you know, we're going to see the same situation of these factions that we're seeing, I think, that are maneuvering to fight it out here. We're seeing the same thing in Europe, and I suspect it's going to proceed in Europe a bit faster than we're seeing it here.
Remember this, a lot of these people came up in 2.0.
Yes, they did.
And the shift to 3.0 is throwing them for a loop, too.
Yeah, it is.
Right.
It is. And Merkel's not got a clue. She hasn't a clue.
Even though she's a physicist?
Well, her degree is in quantum chemistry, and there's even been some flap in Germany over whether or not she actually wrote her thesis.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So we don't know.
So there was one piece we published during the third quarter that was something like the 20 things you need to know about new technology. And, it went into all the changes that are going to come in the next 4 or 5 years, like driverless cars. And one subscriber read it, and she wrote, and she said, you know, you've been talking about this shift to 3.0, but sitting down and looking at all these things, I realized, oh, my God, you know, I'm not mentally ready for this. And I really, really want our subscribers and listeners to get ready for this. If you go back and you look at when we switched from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy, you know, the population, one minute you've got 80-90% of the people working on the land farming.
And then the next.
And in a relatively short period of time, everybody's in the city doing industrial, and you have complete chaos.
Right.
Now, this one is going to go faster. It is going faster.
Yes.
So I don't, you know, I've never lived through the shift from global 2.0 to 3.0, but I'll tell you this. If they're able to abrogate all the contracts in global 2.0, as they're talking about trying to do, and I don't know if that's just a plan to keep the young people entertained and busy or doing what they want, you know, to make them sort of organized and malleable, or whether they're serious about that. So I don't know the extent to which they're planning on abrogating, but most people in America are depending on cash flows from Global 2.0.
Right.
And so I really, who knows how Global 2.0 evolves, implodes, whatever, but I really want to encourage people to think about, you know, what are the different scenarios of what could happen to Global 2.0, and how do you make sure you are thinking about how you make the switch?
Well, to me, the key here is going to be in control of your information,
right,
as much as possible. I think shows like this one are going to survive and probably thrive.
Right.
And I think what people need to start thinking about is doing a similar thing on the scale that they can do it.
Right.
And build up information outlets for local issues and things. I think that, number one, is very critical.
Right.
Because we don't have that. I think you're the only one out there talking in terms of locality. But if people
were... No, there are others.
There are others. But if people were really to start... publishing information you know, on the web, doing websites, podcasts, and so on about local or regional issues.
Right. So we had Chuck Marone of Strong Towns on. I'm excited about what he's doing. Dr. Skidmore is state and local government finance. He teaches county commissioners and other people. You know, we just put up a great article by Gary Heckman, who's a retired city manager up in Michigan, on going local. And, you know, there are a lot of great people. But I think what you and I are saying is we all need to focus on actionable intelligence. We don't have time for fake news anymore.
Right, right. And it needs to be done. We need local versions of Solare Report and so on and so forth. We need these types of things to be done by people on the ground where they are to get information out.
Everyone can get together. I keep saying, get together, or, you know, call it a club, call it a circle, call it whatever you want. But sit down and use it to collect information about what's going on and then to take action. So people say, I can't afford organic food. Yes, you can. Get 10 people together, and once a week, one person goes down to the terminal market and gets cartons of wholesale organic food for everybody.
Well, the other thing is to start building up social circles again. You know, get together and play cards and discuss all of these things. You know, do stuff that we used to do.
Get in the circle. A nurse practitioner who can teach you how to take care of your health. Get an attorney who can teach you how to do, you know, the simple things. Right. Get a banker who can make sure that you're banking at the local bank and you're okay.
Now, there's another thing that I think people need to be aware of that is coming down the pike, and we've mentioned it before in terms of technologies and how they're going to transition from 2.0 to 3.0. Robotics in the home. There are already little robot vacuums, you know, that you can buy that will clean up your, you know. The problem is some of these technologies have already been shown to have little hidden cameras and things that they map your. So you want to be very careful about these technologies, bringing them into your home. They're going to happen sooner or later.
Right.
But the other thing is, if you're concerned about your personal information getting into data banks, there are other alternatives to search engines on the computer to use other than Google. There's a search engine I use called DuckDuckGo.
I use DuckGoGo, but I'm prototyping Brave, which is a new one.
Another one, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Just avoid using the big names, you know, that we know are spying on us. You know, it could be that these things are too. We don't know. But by moving our business away from those platforms, you're already sending a signal. So I think those things are very important for people to do and be aware of. But the robotics in the home, the other big thing that's coming down the pike, we've talked about this, 3D printing. I'm actually kind of enthused about that, because what it will allow people to do is, replace parts.
Make it yourself. Right.
Which, you know, I'm experimenting already. I think that's something that people need to look at. There's all sorts of things that people can do to make good use of this technology and not be subservient to the big multinational corporations.
So here was the story to me that personified the first part of your message, the warning part. You know, to the extent you incorporate digital technology into different applications and appliances and pieces of hardware around your house, you know, it's a two-way street.
Right.
So, you know, there's a great article a couple of years ago about how when you sign the terms and conditions of Samsung, you basically give them permission to watch you and record you.
Right.
So my favorite one of the third quarter was the warning put out by an expert that your sex robot could be hacked and turned into an assassin.
Yeah. your sex robot. I mean, how sick can you possibly be?
Can you imagine buying a... You know, basically, the world has been so worked over and weaponized by the intelligence agencies that now the only way you feel safe having sex
is with a robot.
If the population is weaponized, then you can't afford to have sex with anybody in the population.
Right.
So you spend $10,000 getting a robot, your robot gets hacked and kills you. I mean, that has got to be the saddest story.
It is, and it conjures all sorts of images that I don't want to go there. No, but seriously, you're right. You know,
the end of intimacy. Completely. Even robotic intimacy.
Even robotic intimacy. It's over, folks.
Okay, with that, I want to bring up the Peace of Westphalia. That's a perfect dovetail into the Peace of Westphalia. Mm-hmm. You and I started talking about this about a year or two ago.
Yes.
And it's finally beginning to sink in. So the Peace of Westphalia, among other things, was the 1600s, 1648, established the practice that physical control, basically force, was a monopoly of a sovereign government within that place.
Right.
So if you're in any place on the planet, the only person who has a monopoly on force and can use force within that place is the sovereign government
right.
overseeing that place.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's been, with the exception of many wars that we all know about, it's been a remarkably stable governance, part of the governance structure for, you know, more than 400 years. Mm-hmm. And now what we're watching is that within a 20 to 30 year time, thank you, George Bush and Dick Cheney, it's basically, and this, you know, I take this back to giving the CIA control of the hidden system of finance.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You've basically put the intelligence agencies in charge of, you know, the biggest sort of secret bank in the world. And you have created a situation where you have literally torn up and shredded the Peace of Westphalia without even a discussion.
Yes.
And you have financed the greatest, you know, you've financed all these private corporations creating mercenary armies. And now with cryptocurrencies, you've financed enormous waves of hacking armies.
Yes.
So whether it's cyber armies or physical armies, You have literally shredded and torn up the Peace of Westphalia without even a discussion or mentioning it.
Yes.
It's quite remarkable.
Well, we're probably going to get back to this in part two. The Peace of Westphalia is actually a series of seven treaties. I think seven or eight treaties.
Right.
And what it did was it ended the 30 Years' War, the wars of religion in Europe. And basically the principle of Westphalia was that if you were in a country or duchy or what have you, that was, the sovereign was Catholic, let's say, then
right.
he had to respect and obey equal application of the law to his Protestant subjects and vice versa. If you were in a country that had a Protestant sovereign, he had to obey the law and apply it equally to Catholic subjects. That was essentially the peace. So basically what the Peace of Westphalia did was it enshrined the idea of the sovereignty of law and the equal application thereof. In other words, it was a crucial development in European jurisprudence on the way to what became this country, where you had the equal right. application of law, freedom of religion, and so on and so forth. It was a treaty that a set of treaties that also enshrined something else, and that was the sovereignty of the nation state, which ultimately becomes the sovereignty of the states and individuals in this country. What we see now, and what disturbs me, is that to a certain extent, what you've seen emerge in the last 100 years or so, is you've seen three different types of things emerge. All of them are non-state actors. First of all, you pointed out last night when we were talking about all this, the bureaucracies of just this government alone, but you can pick any government on the face of the planet and you probably have the same thing. You have the bureaucracies of this country, which are acting as sovereign entities, which have a different point of view than other bureaucracies of the same government.
Right,
so
they all have weapons.
And they all have weapons and the ability to use them.
Right.
And so you no longer have a common culture of governance, but we've also got, as Mr. Global keeps pointing out, we've got transnational global corporations, which under law in the Western system of jurisprudence are persons and therefore have a certain amount of sovereignty. And then but they don't have the...
They don't have the obligations,
and that's the problem. Right, and that's the problem.
Right.
And that's the huge problem that has to be looked at long-term and very carefully in the evolution of Western jurisprudence. It would be interesting to see how Russia does this, because they come out of a different theological system that gave rise to all of this, and therefore how do they view corporations? Are they persons? Are they obligated under the law? Do they have rights under the law, and do they have obligations? So anyway, the third actor, I think, is a kind of a non-territorial actor. Not necessarily corporations per se, things like I've been talking about, like the mafia would be an extraterritorial actor, my fascist international would be, whatever you want to call it, things like that. So we've got three new types of actors on right. the world stage that, number one, are not signatories or under any sort of obligation to the Westphalian system, and they certainly, whether they are or aren't, they're certainly not acting as if they are.
Right.
So that has contributed to tearing this thing up. So we need to take a very good, long, hard look, I think, over the long term. This is what scares me about a constitutional convention, because they won't do that.
Right.
And it needs to be done.
Right.
And those aren't the people to do it.
Well, but here's what's interesting. If you take any bank or corporation in the world, your state can enforce against them. First
right.
of all,
right.
they can fire them.
Right.
Because all these companies have contracts or are depository for your state.
Right.
So don't complain about the federal government. Just pull the plug on them in your state.
Right.
And county. You know, look how when the state of California was going to issue script because of the fight over the budget, J.P.
Right.
Morgan Chase refused to take it, honor it, or let them do it.
Right.
And they were over a barrel. I'd fire them in a second. Bam, yeah. you're out.
Yeah, you can't
so
do
that's
business
number
here.
One. But number two, they can pull their charter to operate within a state. A corporation to function within a state has to have approval. And it's one of the things I said in my thing
right.
on how to enforce the Constitution. Get every New York Fed member bank or San Francisco Fed member bank that's done all of these shenanigans.
Right.
Or the contractors who are responsible for the missing money, pull the charter on them in your state.
The problem there is the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution that would probably be used by their lawyers to defend it. But I take your point. Is, yeah, these types of entities do have state charters for the most part that they operate.
No, they may have a charter in Delaware, but they are not allowed to operate in your state if you pull their
right, right.
their right to operate. You
right.
can throw them out.
Right.
Right.
I understand that.
And you don't have to hire them.
But that's not going to address the bureaucracies. And,
right,
and
right, 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 right.
These are the things I think that have torn up Westphalia. So if that system of equality under the law that became a cardinal principle of international law, if that's going to work, then we have to go back. And, you know, I've said this many times. We have to take a very good, long, hard, philosophical look at the development of jurisprudence with respect to these things.
Right.
And I don't see anybody doing that sort of analysis, unfortunately, right now. The other thing about Westphalia that's very, very interesting to me is last year, I forget what his name was, there was a Saudi prince that suggested that they needed to expand the Westphalian system
right.
to include the Islamic world. Which I think, in a certain respect, makes a lot of sense. You know, there's not much sense coming out of Saudi Arabia, so that's, you know, that caught my
right.
attention. Because as things are going now, we're heading to some sort of civilizational conflict with that culture and that civilization, and nobody wants it. You know, they certainly don't want it. I don't think it would be good for us. The only people it's going to be good for are the weapons manufacturers. So I think the Westphalian system has at least caught the eye of other people in the world for very obvious reasons. It's going to be interesting to see if we can make it work. The problem is, in this country, that whole concept of equality under the law is breaking down, and they're deliberately breaking it down. So I don't know if the system can be restored or not. I certainly hope so, but it can't be restored, and I'm going back to my main point here. It can't be restored until we take a long, hard, close, philosophical, jurisprudential look at the evolution of all these things, particularly where the law impacts corporations and particularly where it impacts bureaucracies. Bureaucracies are now acting like legal agents in their own rights for their government, and that that is not the way it's supposed to be. That is not the
way. Well, I would say it another way. They're acting as independent entrepreneurs in the money making. They're using government powers to make money.
Yeah.
Outside the law.
Yes, precisely. Precisely. And you can't have, again, that's only creating more chaos. You know,
right.
Agency A says this, Agency Y says that. And, you know, again, where's the common citizen caught? Well, the common citizen's caught in the crossfire. It doesn't know what to do, doesn't know what to think. The courts themselves are a shambles. The federal court system hardly obeys the Constitution at all.
Right.
You know, we've seen example after example of that.
That's why it's coming down to nut-cutting time.
Yeah.
When I was in the litigation, I have a very dear friend named Court Skinner who started when he was a Silicon Valley executive. And when he left, he started a little not-for-profit to basically take the computers from the big corporations and get them transferred over to the kids in the neighborhood who couldn't afford computers.
Right.
It's called Computers for Everyone. And what he did, in the year where there was the most tension, the life expectancy of one of my computers was 29 days.
Oh, jeez.
I was using all Linux and open source software, which is the most invulnerable to hacking.
Right.
But still in 29 days, I mean, they would destroy them. They could hack them and absolutely destroy them. So the only way for me to stay off online was to get a new laptop every 29 days. And Court would literally throw something together. These things were so old and clunky because you knew it was only going to last 29 days. So why spend money, right?
Right.
And I would get a FedEx package, and definitely the cost of the FedEx was more than the value of the computer. And I would get a new secondhand computer that Court had slapped together from the parts in his garage. And that would keep me online for the next 29 days when he had to send the next one. And literally within a year, he sent me 13.
Jeepers.
Now, here was what was amazing. So here I am getting hacked, my property, my rights being destroyed every 29 days. I can't go to an enforcement agency. There's no one who will help me.
Yeah, I know.
I'm completely...
I know. The government is not functioning for the people anymore.
Well, but there's no law.
There's no law.
It's chaos. Right.
Precisely.
So what I can do is I can manage the chaos. And thank God, if it wasn't for Court, I wouldn't have been able to keep doing the work I was required to do. But, you know, we're going... We are in and we're going into a situation where I think it's going to get much worse.
Oh, yeah, I do too.
So that means I'm in a place and I can have any one of these three groups and multiple groups within those groups. So within a place, I'm subject to the force of literally thousands of groups who can use force against me.
Yeah.
In a place, and I can't figure out who they are.
The same thing has happened to me in a different
right.
way, because I had a lot of books put up by my publishers on a certain ebook format from a certain company whose name won't be mentioned here. And next thing I know, and this has happened to a friend of mine, the next thing I know, all of my books are on free PDF on the internet.
Right.
So this last book, the Hess book, I told my publisher, do not permit any ebooks.
Right.
No ebooks
right.
because they're too easily hacked. So, yeah, you know, this is, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find out that there were people that work for the government involved in some of that. Wouldn't
right.
surprise me a bit.
Well, my favorite one was a couple years ago. You know, I was invited to a conference, and I was kind of suspicious. Why in the world would these guys, you know, pay me to come give a speech? Well, while I was there, I was followed around by two newsletter writers who are people who, I don't respect them. I don't respect their work. I don't like them. I think they're basically in the fear porn business.
Mm-hmm.
So they follow me around. One of them's got a marketing guy who's writing down notes, listening to everything I say. When the conference is over, suddenly my entire subscriber list gets hit with marketing from these two groups.
Uh-huh.
So somehow they had the database.
Uh-huh.
You know, now that's criminal.
Yeah.
And what they do is all the target marketing is using sort of my words and expressions, and it's designed to make it look like they agree with me. And from talking to various subscribers who were all happy and excited about this, It sounded to me like they were probably using entrainment. I can't prove that, but that's what it sounded like.
I've had the same thing happen to me.
Because people would call me in all excited and in a rush. Oh, this is wonderful. They agree with you. I've got to get this because they agree with you. And I'm thinking, what is this? It doesn't make any sense. And I don't know how much money they made from that, but it was basically a criminal hit.
Well, I've had the same thing happen to me.
I'm sure.
I've seen my research popping up in places and with certain people whose names you can probably guess that are spun into these wild directions.
Right.
And, you know, no credit given. I have another friend that this has happened to that, you know, writes in this field of research, and it goes on all the time.
Right.
And I have people emailing me, but did you talk to such and such? Because what they're saying sounds an awful lot like they lifted it from you. Well, yeah, they did.
No, but I don't mind that in the sense that ideas are free.
Sure.
But here's what, you know.
But you're an academic and I'm an academic. What you do is you reference and you footnote and you credit your
source. Right, but here's the thing. When you steal somebody's private, when you hack their list.
That's a different matter. That's
big,
criminal.
Right. So, and especially if they were using entrainment, that is also criminal.
Yeah.
I mean, I really feel like they were doing dirty to people. And that's why I won't get on Facebook, because those lists are going to, they're going to create lists that get used, and I will not be a party to that.
Yeah, I understand.
And our security, you know, we really work hard to, now, the intelligence agencies can get anything they want. And I suspect that's where they got it. I think,
oh, sure.
You know. Anyway, so it's a the story I was going to tell you is one I've told many times on the Slayer Report. In 1998, I was sitting in my office, and a friend of mine, or an acquaintance at the CIA, who's was very senior in strategic planning, sent me an email and with a link to a speech that George W. Bush's governor had given, and the CIA was promoting him to be the next president. They were working on it, and they're trying to make him out to be the education president.
Oh, yeah.
And
remember.
You know, his father tried it, hadn't worked, they were going to do it with him. So he gives a speech on education, and she says, "What do you think?" And I wrote back and I said, "It's so stupid." And she says, "Well, why is it?" She got very upset. "Why is it stupid?" And she says, Well, if you wanted to be the education president, what would you say?" And I said, "Well, here, I would say this." So I wrote out like several paragraphs of what I would say and how I would say it. And I didn't hear back from her. And about 3 weeks later, we're sitting in the office and my attorney's there. And I open up the Wall Street Journal, the attorney opens up the Wall Street Journal. And there is a new report about a speech from Bush for the education. And there's a whole paragraph lifted from my email. And I'm sitting there, I'm saying, did I get paid for this?
No.
Did I get paid for this?
Did you get referenced? Did you get cited?
No, of course not.
Of course not. Of course not. I know.
Right.
I've had that happen to me. I've had television programs. I was contacted by, and again, this goes back not just to rule of law. This goes to something much deeper. This goes to common courtesy and academic academic method.
Right.
If you're basing something on somebody else's idea or using their words, you footnote them and credit them with what you said or with the idea. And that's why I
happen to believe that, you know, you and I will occasionally have a disagreement where I tell you you're much more powerful than you realize. And that's because if you look at how your material is spreading, it's unbelievable, but it's being stolen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it is.
But here's the thing. It's what Ronald Reagan said. He said, you can get anything done in Washington as long as you don't want the credit.
Right.
And so I think it is possible to really shift things in a very positive way. We just have to let them keep stealing it from us.
Well, the problem is when they steal, they spin it in directions that you yourself would
never take it.
You know, this is happening under a certain marketing scheme that we both know about now.
Right.
I've seen it happen before. I gave 30 hours of my time talking to a television producer, and then I see a program with all of these ideas, you know, talked about in the program, and absolutely no mention
right.
that I was consulted. Absolutely
right.
None. Zero
right.
zilch. And from that point, I won't deal with American television. I'll deal with Russian television because
right.
they credit me.
Right.
You know, they know the standard academic game.
Now, you know that McCain put a provision in the new appropriations bill, so the National Defense Authorization Act. Not only did he kick, Mattis asked for an increase, Trump increased the increase, and then McCain increased the increase all the way to $700 billion. So, but one of the provisions he put in was that if it passes and gets signed, RT is not allowed to broadcast in America. He's outlawing Russian TV.
Unreal.
Right.
Unreal. Well, that leaves the internet. You know, I'll still watch it. I'm sorry, Senator McCain.
Right. They can still broadcast on the internet from anywhere.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So much for that. Well, Peace of Westphalia, one of our challenges is we have to realize that we are functioning in places where there are multiple actors
right.
acting with impunity outside the law.
Right.
And one of the chief things we need to think about is how do we provide security for ourselves in a way that is reasonable so that we can be productive.
Right.
Because it's a problem. And this is one of the reasons the gun issue was such a do or die issue. And I think if I could stress anything on whether it's the Constitution or Peace of Westphalia, we're coming into what I call the swine flu moment. I tell the story I told last week on Precious Metals with Franklin, when the swine flu vaccine came out and they were going state to state to mandate it. I called Franklin and I said, you know, I'm not going to take this vaccine because I really believed it could be extremely harmful, even kill you.
Yeah.
And I called Franklin and I said, can I come over to your house and bring my guns? Because I'm going to die in a gunfight. I'd rather die in a gunfight with you than alone. And he said, oh, yeah, we're not taking it either. Feel free to come over because there will be a gunfight. And I think it's one of the reasons they backed down on the swine flu vaccine. Yeah. I think they heard way too many, you know, thousands of phone conversations.
Well, they've been very confrontational in a variety of ways where they have had pushback, you know, the Bundy Ranch incident in
right.
Oregon. There have been incidents like this previous to that where they've tried to go in and do something and been stopped by
right.
locals, you know, that are armed. And
that's their big
bugaboo.
I said I wanted to tell you the senior pilot seniority story. Let me just close this out as we finish the Peace of Westphalia. When I was doing mortgage auction loan sales, we were using the AT&T optimization methodology, which they developed mm-hmm. for routing telephone calls. And then, of course, when bandwidth got cheap, they took the technology and used it for other things. And one of the things they developed it for was airline crew scheduling.
Mm-hmm.
And so an airline would have fantastic variables to optimize against each other when crews wanted, you know, if pilot says, I want to fly this week, but not this week, and that day is my birthday, I don't want to fly that day, and I like going to Europe and Asia, but I don't want to go to South America. You know, all these, you know, it gets fantastically complex. And one of the things they did, because they did these schedulings over many, many years, is over time they could price out the cost of a rule,
right.
whether it was a government regulation or a union rule. And one of the things they discovered was that seniority so constrained the model
yep.
that the people with seniority would do better if they gave up their seniority
yep.
because the optimization would be so much greater. They would get more of what they wanted. And so by insisting on seniorities, the senior pilots made life worse for themselves than if they had had no seniority.
Right.
And to me, in part, that's what we're looking at
yes.
in our society.
Yes.
And by these variety of different groups exercising or having the belief that they can exercise force invisibly whenever they want outside the law, they're basically destroying the whole thing for everybody.
Yes, they are.
Including themselves.
Including themselves, right. ultimately.
Right.
Yes, ultimately.
Which turns us to Russia. Speaking of ruining everything, you know, one of the stories that most struck me in the third quarter was a story by Saker about the Russian general being killed.
Yes.
And Russia then publishing the stories of, you know, special forces in the U.S., U.S. special forces co-locating with ISIS terrorists and, you know, who's really financing ISIS. And I took one look at it. So the implication being World War III is about to start because the Russian thing is escalating. Meantime, out comes a story that NASA's just signed and announced an agreement with Russia to do
yes.
a moon station
yes.
together.
Yes.
Now, if we're about to start World War III, why would we sign a deal with Russia over a moon station?
Especially during the sanctions.
Right.
Yeah. That's, to me, that's highly suspicious, and I'll tell you why. Because a few months ago, Russia also inked a similar deal with the European Space Agency, aka Germany, to do essentially the same thing. So what you have is you have the United States, Germany, and Russia looking like they're going to go out and build this space station somewhere between the Earth and the Moon.
Right.
And what's really interesting here is, to me, is not only, okay, we're going to be cooperating in space, but not here on the ground. And look who's shut out of the deal.
China. Right.
China.
Well, I'm assuming that's why they did it, because they didn't want the Russians to do the deal with China.
That could very well be.
Right.
That could very well be. I suspect there's something else going on here, and it goes back to what we've said before about if you're going to commercialize space, you're going to have to militarize it and weaponize it.
Right.
They're putting heavy assets out there. If this plan goes through, this means they're putting heavy assets out there, and there's no doubt in my mind they're going to be of a military nature. As to why they're doing that, is it simply because of commercialization or something else? I don't know. But yeah, it's highly suspicious. We're demonizing Russia on the one hand, and yet they're trustworthy enough to be involved in a major project in space, which is, you know, the new frontier for everybody.
Right.
You know, what is this? I honestly don't know. The only thing I can think of is if NASA's doing this, it's doing it in behalf of our friend Richard Dolan's idea of a breakaway civilization or breakaway state.
Right.
And this is more the American deep state doing this than the people in Washington that have big problems with Russia. So again, we're back to our two-track civilization idea again. That's the only thing I can think of that explains this.
Well, one of the most phenomenal videos, I thought, in the third quarter was the video of Morgan Freeman shilling for the Rob Reiner's committee on, you know, get to the bottom of the election hacking. And you've never seen Morgan Freeman look so scared and insincere in your life, even in a movie where he's playing somebody who's about to be killed.
Right, exactly.
Right. And so you think, what did they do? Did they threaten his kids? What, you know, it's you watch it, and here is a man who is, I can't imagine what they did to get him to do this, because he obviously does not believe a word he's saying.
Well, it's not only that, but, you know, if we're that concerned about Russia hacking our elections, we're going back to the matter of systems that have no integrity. The elections have no integrity.
Right.
Because, number one, they're predominantly computerized.
Right.
Certain individuals in this country, whose abominable name will not be mentioned by me, but who, Darth Soros, but who, you know, has been heavily involved in financing these color revolutions and Antifa and so on and so forth, they're certainly involved in malfeasance in the elections. But if we're so almighty concerned about Russia influencing our elections, then it has to be a level playing field. We have to be concerned about Israel influencing our elections, which they clearly do. You know, they've got
and
their
we're
own organizations.
Have to stop interfering with every election and, all over the world.
Yeah, and that's the other thing.
Right.
You know, the Germans just had their national elections, you know, last week. And the problem there is the Germans were worried about election hacking, too. But they weren't worried about Russia hacking their elections. They were worried about us hacking their elections. You know, by the way, we did bug the chancellor's phone. So, you know.
Well, you know, one of the things that if you look at how the fake news has kind of rolled out, so far, the Russian story has been made into a joke.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's one of the reasons, you know, we're seeing an effort by Hollywood to revive it.
Yeah.
Because it's not working.
It's not going anywhere. And I think the reason it's not going anywhere is that people realize, okay, if you're going to pick on Russia, then we need to expose all election fraud on the part of both parties in this country. And that's never going to happen.
Right.
And, you know, there are other foreign influence agents available to pick on.
Right. Well, one of the things that came out when I challenged this young activist about implementing the rape of Russia story here, one of the things that came out was essentially, I think very few people in the audience knew what the Rape of Russia was or what really had happened.
Right.
Now, Ann Williamson has joined us on the Salieri Report twice, and of course, Sager's joined us. So we've been through it before, but I think it's worth underscoring the extraordinary reality of what happened. Dmitry Orlov has also been on the Salieri Report. He was from a Russian family, although living in the United States, and went back and spent a lot of time there and has written several good books on what it's like to live when an entire large society, complex society, collapses.
Right.
And I don't think most people understand, whether it's what we did in Russia or what we've done in Latin America with collapsing. We're certainly watching it in Venezuela.
Yes.
So we have a leadership that feels empowered to implode societies.
Yes.
And is going around the world for the last 30 years and imploding a lot of societies. Libya, Haiti, Russia. So tell us about the Rape of Russia and why it's so important we understand it at this moment in time, given what's going on with Russia.
Essentially, what happened was when communism collapsed and the Yeltsin government came in, you had the Russian government selling off all of the nationalized industries that had been nationalized, of course, under the Bolsheviks.
Right, everybody's cash flow stopped.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And they privatized these industries. They set up essentially what were trusts, what would be the equivalent of a Western trust, to sell these things off for pennies on the dollar, or, you know, kopecks on the ruble in this case. And what happened is you had a bunch of Western capitalists move in via the so-called Russian oligarchs, buying up all the state-owned industries and basically plundering the country of its wealth. And this proceeded up to the point that, and there's no doubt in my mind, that this was a decision taken by certain directorates within the KGB to put in Mr. Putin. And they put him in my opinion, for several reasons, two of which were that, number one, Mr. Putin, if you know people in the West that had dealings with him when he was kind of a middle echelon apparatchik in St. Petersburg, then Leningrad.
And he was in Germany.
And he was also as an agent in Germany as well, but I'm talking about after this period, during the, you know, final years of the Soviet Union and then up into the Yeltsin era. There were two things that people always mentioned about him. Number one, he was always very polite and courteous. And number two, he was absolutely incorruptible. He could not be bribed. He would, you know, follow the rules, follow the laws. So that worked in his favor, I think, plus the fact that he does have his doctorate in law,
right,
and international law at that. And I think they put him in because of his intelligence connections, because of his reputation, to handle this problem, which he has. Now, we may not like the way he's handled it in some cases, but what he's done, as you've pointed out, is he's observed the measure of Russian law, and in the course of his government, he's expanded those laws, but he's done so in a most uncommunist way. I mean, he's gone to the Duma, he's passed legislation through the Duma, and so on and so forth. So, you know, he's not ruling by decree, contrary to the way the Western press portrays him. And the other thing that he has done that at least Russians like is he stood up for their national culture.
Right.
You know, we all remember the Pussy Riot thing, where you had a rock group go in during an Orthodox liturgy and basically commit sacrilege. You know, off to jail you go. The Western press just howled in indignation with that, and I congratulated him.
Right.
Because, number one, that's not behavior that anybody should condone.
Right.
The only reason the Western press condone it is because they're basically and essentially anti-Christian, as far as I'm concerned. But he stood up for the Russian national culture. And this has become, I think, without getting into detail, this has become the hallmark of his administration, and I think that it reflects a deep analysis that the Russians were undertaking right as the Gorbachev era was coming to an end, and which has certainly continued under Putin and some of his academic advisors. I think they took a detailed analysis of the failures of the system and came to the conclusion that sooner or later this whole thing has to be scrapped.
Right.
Whether it's the Communist Party of the Soviet Union that does the scrapping or whoever, it needs to be scrapped. And central to their analysis, I think, was that this system that they were under was fundamentally inhuman, number one, and that's why it wasn't working, and number two, it was not at all reflective of the indigenous shape of Russian culture and tradition. So what you see Putin doing, this is very interesting to me, what you see Putin doing is he's not only speaking to that when he makes his public speeches,
right,
but he's also taking that and offering cultural critiques of the West.
Right.
The pedophilia scandals, the vaccines, GMOs, non-nutritious food, the whole gamut. And what he's doing is...
What's interesting is as he does it, basically without saying it, he's saying, your culture is inhuman.
Yes.
We will not tolerate an inhuman culture.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. And he's also speaking for those people in the West that say the same thing.
Right.
So he's playing a very, very clever soft power kind of cultural geopolitics by pointing out the hypocrisies and systemic inadequacy in the West.
If he keeps it up, if the Russians can maintain this,
mm-hmm.
within two generations, they will have a fertile population and we will have an infertile population.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's interesting that one of the things he did is he's given tax breaks now to Russians having children.
Right.
And over here we're slaughtering them.
Right.
So, yeah. That, to me, is a clear signal that they took an analysis of the communist system, you know, and all of its detailed aspects, and are rejecting it and trying to move back to something that is rooted in Russian institutions and culture. This does not mean that, you know, they're going to restore the czars tomorrow or what have you. But it does mean, as far as I'm concerned, and I've always maintained this, that with Putin's Russia, you know, if they get rid of Putin, they may think that they're getting rid of the problem. I can assure you that's not the case. Because Putin is reflective. He's not an individual.
He's reflective of a power structure.
He's reflective of a power structure that's done a prolonged analysis of the situation, both internally and externally. And these are the conclusions that they've come to. And I'm absolutely insistent on that. So what I've always said, and I believe it, is that Russia's the first post-postmodern state. It has looked at all of the isms of modernism, communism, fascism, progressivism, so-called liberalism, and said, no, none of those are working. So we're gonna launch out on our own and do our own thing and try and root it somehow in our culture and its institutions. Now, whether that experiment in the long term will work or not, I don't know. But I think you're absolutely right. They've targeted the inhumanity of what has emerged as Western culture, which really isn't. But they've targeted the inhumanity of it. And they've noticed the hypocrisies, the systemic hypocrisies in it. And have said, you know, we're not going down that road either. Because it's just a soft form of what we've just been through.
Right.
So, yeah, he's a very, very unusual man. Russia's a country to watch.
Now, they've just said that they weren't taking dollars at several of the ports.
Yeah, that's true.
And they've agreed to be trading oil and with gold and yuan. And
yep.
They're setting up lots of other payment mechanisms.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
And
don't forget, they got Japan 2 years ago. They got Japan's Japan credit system. into their system so that they can use the Japanese system that's in so many places in the Pacific. So, yeah, they've made a number of very, very key moves. Most recently, they've offered technical assistance to Japan for the Fukushima mess.
Right.
So, yeah.
It's funny. That got very little attention, but that is a major development.
Oh, it's huge. Right. It's massively huge.
Right.
And you know, the joint development that they've Abe and Putin have signed for the Kuril Islands.
Right.
That, too, is another huge, huge agreement. And that's a geopolitical earthquake, whether we realize it or the empire at the Pentagon realizes it or not. That's a huge geopolitical earthquake.
Well, of course, the big question on Russia is, because part of this, even though Russia's in the BIS system, you know, they're part of the trading relationships right. with North Korea that makes it possible for North Korea right. to stay out. We have a new round of sanctions trying to pressure Russia, China, everyone to stop
right.
helping North Korea. It's very much in Putin's interest, I would think, for North Korea to stay out.
Oh, absolutely. The last thing that Russia needs is a bunch of North Korean refugees pouring into eastern Siberia.
Right.
And for same thing for the Chinese. You know, the right. last thing they want is for a bunch of refugees pouring into Manchuria.
Right.
From North Korea's standpoint, you know, playing devil's advocate here, if I were looking in dealing with the United States and the way it's behaved over the last 70 years, I'd want a nuclear deterrent too, you know, quite frankly. You know, communists, even though they are, from a standpoint of their own national self-interest, it makes sense to me. And, you know, they're not going to use it, but as long as they have it, you know, it's going to be a difficult nut to crack. And that's
they'll be free
thinking.
To stay out of the BIS system.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. It's funny, one of the subscribers said to me, wait a minute, you mean I should be rooting for North Korea?
Well, I'm not rooting for them, but I'm simply saying that, you know, they've taken a decision in their own national interest, and this is the problem, because the globalists don't want anybody to think in terms of national interest.
Right.
And that's the problem. You know, a few years ago, most people don't remember this about North Korea and Russia and China and Japan and South Korea. The South Koreans elected a government that attempted, made noises that, you know, we can solve this ourselves, you know, amongst Koreans. And, of course, the next thing you know, the U.S. put the squeeze on and that government was out right. of power. So, yeah, this is a tempest in a teapot. I don't think North Korea is ever going to give up a nuclear deterrent. I don't think that we would go in there, especially now. We'll get into this in part two, given some of the things that we've discovered about our military holes. But
right. So third quarter, looking ahead, so this has been financial economy and financial markets and geopolitics. Looking ahead to the fourth quarter, what do you think are going to be, given what's happened in the third quarter, what do you think are the things that the people listening to this need to consider and think about and watch for in the fourth quarter?
Well, the first thing they have to watch for is they have to watch for the increasing use of culture, of the multicultural agenda to drive fundamental revisions in the financial and governance structure of the country.
Right.
In other words, Constitutional Convention. This is what the ultimate objective is. Look for signs of that to continue and to increase. I would also expect eventually you're going to start hearing about pushback that, okay, if one political section of the country can have its own social justice warriors going out and causing chaos, we can too. I think that's coming down the pike, unless, you know, they get a handle on the other by some
other
mechanism.
Well, remember, through Bitcoin, they can launder tremendous amounts of money anonymously to people and pay them to run around and do ridiculous
exactly.
things.
Exactly. Right. That's exactly
right.
What
and
I'm thinking.
And people who are not having tremendous money laundered into them have to go to work.
Right. Right. So, yeah, I would look for that.
Let me just stop you here, because one of the things, it's so important and it's not happening. When I see those folks, you know, whether they're breaking windows or whatever, what I see is a paid employee.
Yes.
Who's simply doing their job.
Right.
Right. I don't take them seriously. It's like reality TV. Right. You know, they're paid to break those windows, and it's a job, and that's what they do. And it's like the Truman Show.
Yeah.
And so I don't take them seriously because it's an op.
Yeah, it is an op.
Yeah, so we need to get over, we need to get real about it's an op. That's yes. all it is.
Yes.
You know, it's you know, think of it as a mini street theater false flag. It's an op, and we now need to stop taking it seriously. And we need to just, you know, there are many different ways to handle each situation, and everybody's different. But I think the time has come to stop, you know, we've got to stop laying back and say, you know something? This is our country. If you want to get a job breaking windows, you need to go elsewhere.
Right. Oh, so, I agree.
Right. So I agree. I think the American people need to get over their embarrassment, their political correction, their shame, and we need to start asserting the law. And whatever that means in right. your situation, whatever you want to do. And if you look at the second quarter wrap-up, there are tons of ideas of what everybody can do, and some everybody's different. So I'm not telling you which ones are for you, but if everybody did what they could,
right.
a mighty army.
Well, again, it's a matter of withdrawing support from mechanisms that no longer represent your individual worldview.
Right.
And I would, again, I'm gonna hammer my favorite topic here. That means, first and foremost, the universities and colleges.
Right.
Quit sending your kids to these institutions
right.
that are turning out nothing but social justice warriors and people with studies in women's rights or women's studies
right.
or,
you
know, this claptrap.
You can't afford to spend $60,000
on claptrap
to have your kids come home, you know, having consumed enormous amounts of entrainment and mind control.
Yes. Yeah, and you have to start standing up for those professors that have been speaking out against it and that are under fire in those
right.
universities.
Right.
That's also crucial, because this is not going to get turned around unless we recapture the academy.
Right, and there's also plenty of schools abroad you can
go. Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
So if ours are just mind control laboratories,
right.
let's go elsewhere.
Right. Right. Or start our own.
Right, exactly. Start our own. So, I don't know. To me, there's so many different ways to contribute to it, but we're going to have to get serious.
Oh, absolutely.
The other thing is the missing money issue is coming to a head.
Yes.
I've seen so much spin in the third quarter saying, oh, well, Social Security is an entitlement and Americans are too materialistic and there's $20 trillion of debt and there's no money. And all of that is a lie.
Yes.
And we can't let that lie stand.
No, we can't.
Right. So one of the reasons I keep redundantly pushing the missing money story is, you know, anytime you're at dinner and somebody says, well, there's no money, you say, well, that's not true.
Right.
You know, and it's all there. We've made it public. Yeah. Anybody can read it. Anybody can get it. They can get the government documents. It's time we go on the offensive about the spin on this.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
Make, you know, create so many fronts
right.
that they can't deal with all of them.
Right.
That's the key.
Right.
So far, they've been very successful keeping everybody divided and in a herd mentality. And it's not about that. So I go back to what I said previously. Figure out what you can do that will give you some pleasure and happiness in doing it, by way of sharing information at, you know, in your neighborhood, your city, your township, whatever, and start putting this information out there and just start being a huge nuisance.
I just did another interview with Greg Hunter on the missing money. And one of the things he said, oh God, I love math. I love money, because then it's everybody. He said, this is $65,000 for everybody, black, white,
yes.
male, female,
yes.
old, young. I mean, imagine $65,000 it's almost $250,000 per family of four.
Yeah. Yeah. That's obscene.
Right.
And that has been stolen from people.
Right.
So these people, yeah, we know who these people are. They're the banks. They're the big corporations. They're the, you know, the hedge funds and so on. Just look at the rape of Argentina, for that matter, on hedge funds. We know who these people are. And it's time to let them know we know who you are.
Right.
And then, you know, the real crunch comes, we know where you live. So yeah, it's like we said when we were talking previous to recording, it's coming down to a choice between, do you want to live under a system of slavery and death?
Yes.
Which is what really they have planned for everybody.
And infertility. Judging from,
yeah. And infertility.
Do you want your children and grandchildren to be infertile?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Or do you want us to live under a system that you're still free?
Right.
And, you know, that may require your death at some point. But, you know, there's things, as you said, there's things worse than that.
For many of us, I think it's going to come down to a swine flu moment.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing, because I've been through this in the litigation, I had to decide which was more important, my freedom or my life.
Yeah.
And I chose my freedom.
Yeah.
Because if there's anything I can communicate, I keep saying it, I'll say it again, death is not the worst thing that can happen.
No, it isn't.
Right.
It isn't.
Right.
Yeah. You know, if you don't have freedom, you don't have life.
Right.
You're just living through the motions. You know, right. You're living a facsimile of it.
Right.
And that's fundamental. And, we need to learn from history. Every tyrannical system in history thinks that it's the latest and best and we'll make it work this time because we have the best technology.
It's different this time, really.
It's different this time. Yeah, we have the technology. We've got all of our ideology down correctly. And it never works.
Right.
Ever.
Right.
Because it's inhuman.
Right, there's no life.
There's no life. It's inhuman.
Yeah, it's inhuman. Okay, well, Joseph, this has been a rich discussion. Tell us again. So remember, everybody, we're planning on the crowdfund, the Oregon coming Thanksgiving.
Sometime.
We'll have lots to give thanks for in the Thanksgiving, but we want you to definitely, we ask your prayers for our very, very busy, overworked
Oregon. Builder, yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris Morton. And then your book is available. Tell us again the name.
It's called,
and how we get it.
It's called Hess and the Penguins, and the subtitle is The Holocaust, Antarctica, and the Strange Case of Rudolf Hess. I don't have it up on my website yet, but you can get it through the publisher, Adventures Unlimited, or Barnes & Noble, you know, those places. So, yeah, it is out. It's definitely a book worth reading, I think.
Yeah, so I've started it, and it's a...
It's a
what do you call it? A whopper doozy?
It's a whopper doozy. Yeah. The more you... The further you get into it, the bigger and bigger and bigger you're thinking, oh, my word. Yeah, it's a whopper doozy.
Well, here's the thing. If you want to try and understand what's happening in Antarctica, you have to know the history.
Yes.
Yeah, you have to know the history.
If you want to know what's going on in Antarctica, you have to understand that the modern history of it really begins with the Nazi expedition in 38 and 39 that was sponsored by Hermann Göring, of all people. You know? And, you know, this guy's not sponsoring a science fair, you know. That's not his bailiwick, but yeah, and the Hess case is a part of that in my argument, a very big part of that.
Well, the other thing I noticed in the acknowledgments, you put my name in them, and I was very touched because, needless to say, my collaboration with you is a source of great amazement, information, learning, astonishment, and laughter.
Well, I put you in there because we've both been wondering what the heck is
going
on down?
What is going on in Antarctica?
I don't know, but I think Hess was a part of it, whatever it was, and Göring. what a weird group of people when you stop and think of it. Hermann Göring, Rudolf Hess, Richard Byrd, Admiral Byrd, and then you find out James Forrestal and Fleet Admiral Nimitz were involved in planning that whole thing. And then, you know, in more recent times, you've had Apollo astronaut Buzz Aldrin. You've had the Secretary of State, John Kerry.
And the Secretary of State's there during the election.
And during the election, of all things.
During the election.
And the Patriarch of Moscow.
Is there with the Pope.
He wasn't there down there with the Pope, but he went down there after he met the Pope.
Right after the Pope.
Dig a little further, and you find out King Juan Carlos and the... Prince Harry.
It looks like, you know, when the owners land, everybody comes from, you know, from all around the country to bring tribute.
Yeah, you know, just exactly why is Antarctica an international zone? and this is part of, you know,
as you said, it's not on the way to someplace.
It's not on the way to anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and all of those 19th century claims on Antarctica have just, you know, since World War II, fallen by the wayside. And right. I think that's part of the story.
Well, anyway, so tell us the name again. Hess and the Penguins.
Hess and the Penguins, The Holocaust, Antarctica, and The Strange Case of Rudolf Hess.
Okay.
The book is about Hess, not Antarctica, but there is a part of Antarctica.
Yeah, but you definitely need to know the Nazi angles if you're interested in Antarctica. Okay, well, Joseph, great discussion. We look forward next week to discussing part two. We're going to be talking about culture, science and technology, the unanswered questions that still plague us. What are the penguins doing down there in Antarctica? And so I look forward to our discussion next week. Thank you so much again.
Thanks for having me on.
Bye.